Can we have Parliament staff to say something?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Zola Weiss. I'm the committee secretary.
Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'm Lomas Biela. I'm a committee researcher.
Morning, Steven Smolen for communication support for the committee.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. The delegation will start with the PSC.
Good morning, honorable chair and committee members. My name is Kumalele Nzimande. I'm a commissioner in PSC.
Good morning, chairperson and members of the committee and colleagues. I am Richard Sizan, deputy chairperson of the Public Service Commission.
Good morning, honorable members, honorable chair. Richard Levine, the director general of the Public Service Commission.
Good morning, honorable chair and the members of the committee. My name is Amanda Kilanushe. I'm the content support for PSC.
Good morning, member. My name is Rose Kwaza. I'm a parliamentary officer of the Public Service Commission.
Okay, EPSA.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Alex Mahava. I'm just holding the fort for the DG for this week only. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable members. Jiva Kule from the Department of Public Service and Administration.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. I'm Barbara Watson, also from the DPSA.
Sorry, I was looking for other colleagues of mine, but my name is Cornel, I use DPSA.
Chair, the name is Colette Clark from Branch Research and Policy Analysis, DPSA.
Sita?
Morning, Chair. My name is Freeman Lombardo, the Chief Executive Officer of CETA.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Tanya Abraham from CETA PLI.
Have I left anyone else? Simon?
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Michael Sass. I'm the Accountant General from National Treasury.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tim Megile Pilaki, Parliamentary Liaison, National Treasury.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Lindsay Bordovic from the National Treasury.
All right. Normally, we also allow members of the public journalists to also introduce themselves so that we should know who's here. At the back, if you could please introduce yourself.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Yin Yarabo from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Thabo Mokoni. I work for the Sunday Times.
Good morning. My name is Baba Alo, and I work for independent newspapers.
Good morning. My name is Abe Edu, and I'm with PNG Law.
Good morning. I'm Zanele Keke from HSA.
Karen Coleman from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Camila Abrams, DPSA, Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Okay,
Okay, thank you very much. You're all welcome. Can you then take a presentation by the Department of Public Service and Administration? I don't know how are you going to structure it. What are you going to have one person presenting, or you're going to be breaking? Then we'll take. We'll then discuss once the presentation, because I can see that we're going to have different presentations. So then I'll afford the first presenter to then take us through. I don't know how you've agreed. Have you agreed on any?
Thanks. Yeah, we will have a presentation from two. We'll have Cornel Ace, and then we'll also have Chiba PA, who's going to present. And then after that, I don't know if it was recorded. We just want to indicate that the minister is at cabinet. He's not able to reach today. And also we got a message, our deputy minister, she's not well. But what we are going to start with, it will be a presentation from IFMS. It will be done by Mr. Colonel Ace. I think he can start with the presentation. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, members, colleagues, thanks for this opportunity. Just to give you some context to the presentation, thank you, Chair. Like I said, I think just as an introduction, it's important to note there has been previous presentations to the Portfolio Committee on IFMS, but the last one was around 2013, early in 2013, and there has been some significant progress made since then, and important developments which we would like to share with the committee today. And although it's a DPSA presentation, I will make that I have colleagues from CETA and Treasury here. IFMS is a joint project between the three entities, and my colleagues will also make contributions where necessary and assist with the answering of questions. Chair, to start, and I assume people have hard copies of it, if we can look at page 3 or slide 3, it's just briefly what IFMS is. And I know for some people this is old news, we've explained it before. But for the new members, and I'll try to simplify things as far as possible, and maybe I should just interrupt myself here as well. IFMS is not primarily an IT project, although we use a lot of IT terminology, and an IT system will be the basis of the IFMS. It is primarily about transforming the way that the public service is doing business in order to improve our back office processes and ultimately through that service delivery in the public service. But then back to what IFMS is. In simple terms, it is a program that is aimed at modernizing the current back office systems in the public service. That's the systems that provide functionality that assist us to perform human resource management, financial management, supply chain management, payroll functions, business intelligence. So for those members that is familiar with the public service, you will know we currently use systems like Parsol, BAS, Logos, Blindela. All those systems will, over time, be replaced by the IFMS. Jay, if we can go to the next slide again, this is some context for new members, why we are busy with this initiative. First of all, our current systems, the Parsols, BASs, and so on, is old. They have generally been developed during the 1980s. It's built on old technology. The type of skills that is necessary to maintain these systems are becoming scarce and therefore very costly. And it's becoming increasingly difficult and also expensive to maintain them. We believe that the implementation of new modern systems will assist us in the transformation efforts that we are busy with. Very importantly, to improve the quality of data. We know that is an ongoing problem and an old problem in the public service. We believe that the functionality that the modern systems have by making data more visible to people will assist in improving the quality of that data. New systems have got new functionality like self-service, which allows individual public service to engage directly with the systems, therefore increasing efficiency of processes.
The one typical example is leave management, where people can apply for leave online in a modern system. It can be approved online. There's no longer a paper form that needs to be completed that might get lost, that might not be captured. And through that, there's important savings and efficiencies to be gained. Then maybe lastly to mention that the type of systems we are looking at the moment is built on so-called international best practices. As a result of the numerous organizations that use it, also public sector organizations, and we believe because of the inherent functionality in these systems, it will allow us to improve our business processes. And through all of this, we will support the implementation of important government initiatives like the National Development Plan. Chair, the next slide again talks about some of the benefits of using these systems. It will in future be possible to interact remotely with them through the use of mobile technology. Some functionality can be used from a cell phone. It doesn't even have to be a smartphone. It can be a very basic cell phone. You can do things like apply for leave on that. You can view your payslip, possibly make your travel arrangements and so on. We believe that the quality of data will be improved, that decision making will be improved. Business processes will be better and more efficient because these systems can interface with other government systems. A typical example, again, is when you appoint a person, our IFMS will be able to interface to the Population Register in Home Affairs, and you can check whether a person is a South African citizen. Or similarly with SAQWA to check whether the business qualifications are valid and recognized qualifications. And then, as I mentioned, through the automation of processes, we believe there's big benefits to be gained. Chairperson, members, the next three slides give a graphical high-level overview of the history of IFMS. Again, I think it's important for new members. The initial steps on the IFMS commenced in 2002 when the Budget Council instructed National Treasury to look at an initiative to modernize the financial systems, which was in use at that point in time. And subsequent to that, there was a decision taken to include all the current transfer systems in the scope of the IFMS. Initial work was done, and an important milestone was in 2005 when we went to Cabinet, and Cabinet approved the IFMS. Now, what is important to point out at this point in time is, at that point, Cabinet approved a so-called hybrid solution architecture, and I will try to explain that in simple terms. It simply means that the IFMS would have consisted as it was conceived at that point in time from a combination of in-house developed systems that CETA would primarily have been developing for us, as well as some systems that were procured from industry. If one goes to the next page, by 2010 we have had the first systems that were available. That was an asset management system which CETA developed. It was implemented in Treasury and in some departments in Limpopo, as well as a human resource management system which we procured from industry, and it was implemented in DPSA as a pilot or lead site, as we like to call it. 2011 there was further systems implemented, a catalog management system and a procurement management system, again procured from industry and implemented in Treasury as lead site or pilot site. And 2012-2013, we commenced with the development of the outstanding systems. But as you can note for yourself, from 2005 to 2013, there was a significant period of time spent, and there was a view that we need to reconsider the approach. And as a result, three independent surveys or investigations into the IFMS was commissioned. One was conducted by Ernst & Young, which is, an audit firm. One was done by the World Bank, and one was done by Gartner, which is an IT advisory firm. And they all came to essentially the same conclusion, that we need to reconsider the solution architecture of IFMS. And there was a feeling that this hybrid approach, which I explained, which was a mix of in-house developed systems and commercial off-the-shelf systems, might not be the most optimal for us. And they recommended that we should look at the implementation of a single commercial off-the-shelf system that provides the full range of functionality from HR management, financial management, supply chain, payroll, and business intelligence. The second important recommendation that emerged from these reviews was that we need to strengthen the project management or the program management of IFMS. And they recommended that we establish a strong and well-resourced program management office that will drive the execution.
Chair, then the last slide with the arrows and dots on it, just explain where we stand at the moment. Based on those recommendations, we went back to Cabinet in 2013, and Cabinet approved the revised solution architecture so that in future there will only be a commercial off-the-shelf system being used. Subsequent to that, we published a tender to procure the software for that. There was objections from industry. We obtained legal advice to deal with that, and while we were considering the legal advice, the tender lapsed. And that forced us basically to reconsider our procurement approach, and I will talk in a future slide or a further slide to that. But in 2013, we also started the establishment of the PMO, which I will again talk about in a further slide in more detail. And then, well, the next steps, we are currently busy with procurement, but let me get to that when I get to those slides. Chair, the next slide I think is important, maybe just to explain who does what in IFMS. It shows the three key stakeholders, the National Treasury, DPSA, and CETA. Treasury, in simple terms, would be, well, we use the term project sponsor, but that simply means Treasury is the entity that is paying for IFMS. They currently are funding the initiative, but they are also the policy owners for financial management, for payroll, and for supply chain. And then they also manage the current legacy systems, the payroll status, and so on. DPSA, our focus is predominantly on the human resource management side or the functionality of IFMS. And then CETA is looking at the integration of systems, the IFMS with external systems. They provide technical support to the IFMS program, and they will also host the solutions on their infrastructure. The lower part of the slide, I don't want to spend too much time on that, but we've got a fairly well-developed and also complex governance model where there's provision for ministerial oversight, predominantly by the Minister of Public Service and Administration and Finance, who look at do oversight over IFMS from a political perspective. There's a steering committee that consists of the DGs of Treasury and DPSA, as well as the CEO of CETA, who provides strategic direction on for the IFMS program. Then there's an SLA committee that do the operational management and so forth. I don't think I need to elaborate on all of that, Chair. The project reviews, I already spoke about that. That's the next slide, slide 10. But I think just what is important here, some of the reasons why there was a recommendation made for the change in the solution architecture. The view that the maintenance cost of the hybrid approach that we were embarking on at that stage was going to be very complex, very expensive and complex compared to a cost-based solution. There was a view that we would need too many or a large number of highly skilled technical professionals to maintain a hybrid approach where we develop the systems rather than just buying something off the shelf and where there's a lot of skills available in the market to do maintenance. And obviously integration, which has been a problem in the past, would be less complex because you buy an integrated system off the shelf.
Can the presenter make sure that there are provisions there which like COT basis? What is that? Can you be told about abbreviations so that you understand and you go with the presentation?
Honourable Chair, my apologies. You know, when we talk, because this is the things we work with, we assume people know. I'm sorry if that wasn't explained. COTS means commercial off the shelf. So it's the systems that you buy from industry. I will. If I see further abbreviations in the presentation, I will explain. Excuse me. In the next slide, these are some of the benefits we believe is attached to the change in the solution architecture. Again, integration will be much simpler. We will be able to start sooner with the full rollout to the whole of the public service. You know, the public service consists of approximately 160 departments. That's going to be our first focus, but that will be mean that we have to implement and do some work in each of these departments. And as members probably know at this point in time, the Public Administration Management Act has been signed into law, which means that at some stage we will also have to look at the implementation of IFMS in local government. That is not currently within the scope of the current project, but it is something that is sitting in our future and which we will have to deal with at some point in time.
I previously mentioned the fact that these systems are based on international best practices. We believe it will help us with improving our resource management. And then importantly, because it is such a large undertaking, there is a view, and we firmly believe, that the implementation of IFMS will also assist with the development of skills in the ICT industry in the country. When we start with the national rollout, there's going to be scope for a wide range of companies, from small startup type companies up to large, big consulting type firms, doing a range of things like the configuration of the system, training and development, change management, data migration, and so forth. Chair, if I move on to the next slide, slide 12, I don't want to spend time on that, just showing what the cabinet decision was. Maybe just to explain the concept of a vanilla solution, which is mentioned in the first bullet point. Cabinet approved that we should go for a so-called vanilla solution. No, simply that means you try to retain the system as far as possible as you buy it. So you try to limit the changes to be made to the system as far as possible. In order to facilitate future upgrades, maintenance, and so on, the more you change the source code of the system, the more difficult it becomes to maintain it over time. So we are going to go into an implementation and try to retain the system as much as largely as it is as we buy it. But obviously, we understand the public service is unique, and there will have to be some changes made to it. Chair, where we currently stand, and that's slide 13 onwards. Immediately after the cabinet decision was taken, we paused the work on the development of the systems that were ongoing at that point in time. But we also decided that we will retain the systems that's already been implemented on the IFMS, and those will be retained until they are potentially replaced by a new solution. We started the process of engaging with the service providers we currently have on board in order to determine the impact of the change in the solution architecture on their contracts. It's a process being led by the CEO of CITA. Then importantly, we also started the process through our program management office to look at the various policy frameworks in the public service, in HR, finance, supply chain, and so on, to determine to what extent there would be a need for adaption of these policy frameworks as a result of the implementation of the system, also to determine where we might have to potentially change the system to suit our requirements. That process is currently ongoing in consultation with the various so-called policy owner departments like DPSA and National Treasury. Chair, the next slide, 13, that's 14, it speaks to the procurement process we are busy with. I've already mentioned we did issue a tender that was not awarded as a result of objections from industry. Then we decided we are going to go into the procurement process for a new solution in a three-phased approach. The first phase being looking only at the software. That tender was published at the end of last year. It's already been adjudicated. The approval process is currently going on, and we believe by the end of the month we will have a final decision on that. As soon as that is done, we will publish a next tender to obtain services from industry to implement this set of software in a number of lead side departments to pilot it or to test it. And then there will be a subsequent further tender at a later point in time to obtain services to implement the solution in the whole of the public service. Chair, next slide speaks to the program management office which we have established. It is currently being upscaled further. Additional capacity is being appointed. We already have capacity that deals with program management in it, strategic systems planning, that is currently the people that look at our policy frameworks. There's a team of people that look at change management and communication, and then also a company that do probity services. Now, probity services is similar to audit services. They ensure that we do things according to the rule book, especially around procurement and so forth. In terms of communications, we have launched a dedicated IFMS website. The URL, the address is there on the slide. And we try to publish information on a regular basis on the website so that we keep people informed of what's happening. It's a recent development, and we will expand on the website as we go forward. We also have a dedicated communications committee because it is an area that I think we've neglected in the past, and we want to communicate much more going forward to a range of various stakeholders. Chair, then next slide, slide 16. Importantly, we've also started the process of gauging the readiness of departments for the adoption of IFMS. Current focus is on IT infrastructure to check that the local area networks, the desktop infrastructure is suitable to accommodate the IFMS, to identify potential gaps, and if necessary, to allow budget departments to budget, to upgrade it where necessary. And there will also be future surveys done to look at things like the people issues, for example, the computer literacy of the employees, stable a department is in terms of its organizational structure. That will inform the change management activities and training activities that we have to embark on. Chair, the second part, slide 17, speaks to a couple of other points. Importantly, when Cabinet agreed to the IFMS way back in 2005, there was a moratorium placed on the acquisition of systems by departments in order to limit unnecessary expenditure. That moratorium is still in place, but where a department has an urgent need for systems, they can approach National Treasury for approval to deviate from the moratorium. I think I said the rest. We will retain the current IFS modules, which is already in service, as well as the legacy systems. They are being maintained until we can replace them with the IFMS. Chair, the last slide, slide 18, just gives a high-level overview of the next steps. So our first priority now is to finalize the procurement of the software. Then we are going to go into the procurement of services for the lead side implementations, finalize that over the next 2 years, and by 2017 we want to start the rollout to the whole public service. That's beyond the lead side, and that process should be concluded by April 2021. That is the date that we committed to Cabinet and when we must be finished. So we are under severe pressure to get this done as quickly as possible, but we believe it is doable at this point in time. Honourable Chair, that's it. Thank you, and thanks, members.
We'll be dealing with the filling of vacancies in the public service, as well as the verification of qualifications and the personal suitability checks. My colleague, Ms. Barbara Watson, will be dealing with the issues around the targets for senior management at 50% and 2% for the employment of disabled people. Chair, in dealing with the issue of the filling of vacancies, I think the key issue is that while there are targets for addressing it, the filling of vacancies, in fact, is a strategic orientation and is dependent on the organizational structuring of departments, the human resource plan, as well as the recruitment plan. And failure to address those issues at a strategic level mean that departments invariably become very reactive and start to engage in transactional recruitment just to fill vacancies rather than addressing the bigger needs of the organization. In terms of the presentation, I will be taking you through the background for the public service in terms of recruitment, dealing with the average funded vacancy rate. We will limit our discussion to funded posts, not any post that's on the establishment. The median period to fill posts, that means the time taken to fill a vacancy. Some of the emerging trends, historical as well as going forward. We'll deal with the issue of the personal suitability checks, which will speak to two organizations, the role of the personal suitability checks from the State Security Agency, as well as the South African Qualifications Authority, SAQA. And then in the way forward, share with you some of the challenges as well as the interventions from the Ministry of Public Service and Administration. Chair, you will recall in terms of the National Development Plan, one of the key priorities identified in the chapter for public service and administration was the high vacancy rates in government, which have been chronic pre-2012. And in terms of outcome 12, that drives many of the targets in the NDP, the medium-term strategic framework actually addresses the issues of the filling of vacancies and the turnaround time for filling them in terms of identifying two key targets. That means the average vacancy rate in the public service should not be more than 10%, and we should not take longer than 6 months to fill a post. And since the inception of these targets, the DPSA has been monitoring them and reporting to the minister on issues arising as well as interventions required. Chair, in calculating the vacancy rate, I think it's important to note that the vacancy rates are essentially a target, but they don't stand in isolation. They are dependent on a number of variables and form part of the strategic value chain. If a functional structure of a department is not approved, it has an implication for the filling of posts. If a department does not have an approved HR plan, they invariably run into problems around recruitment and the filling of critical skills for their department. And if departments fail to have stringent recruitment processes, a collapse in the processes means there's a delay. And linked to the issues of appointment, even if you have efficient processes, is if there are delays in vetting of individuals, personal suitability checks, as well as verification of qualifications, you fail to meet the targets. So it's a complex issue. It's not just about the numbers. In the methodology, Chair, we've shared with how we calculate the vacancy rate, and these have been communicated to departments, and they use this as a form of self-assessment as well. The period we use to calculate how long it takes to fill a post, we generally consider a post that's been vacant over a medium-term expenditure framework, MTEF period, so over a three-year period. So all posts within an MTEF period which are linked to the funding is what we measure. So if a post falls outside that period, we do not calculate it. It's important to also note that previous presentations made by DPSA on the personnel cleanup are critical to this process, because where departments have failed to maintain their personnel, their targets can look very skewed and be far off the measure set by the public service. And that's an ongoing process in the public service. Chair, on page 5, the historical trends in the vacancy rate are depicted. In terms of our measures, we generally measure quarterly and report biannually to the minister. So at the end of June 2012, the average vacancy rate for the public service was 9.68%, and you can see that a quarter later, it dropped to 8.58. On the 31st of December of 2012, it went to 9.2, and by July 2013, it had decreased to 8.86. And at the beginning of 2014, it was 9.56, well within the targets for the period of up to 2013. The median time to fill vacancies also improved substantially. It was reduced to 5.9, 4 months, and then 4.95 months. There was a big decrease, because our baseline when we started with vacancy rates was in pre-2009 was around 40%. And that was contaminated by poorly maintained personnel data. So the success of some of the interventions can be shown. Chair, on the next slide, what we have captured there is the average vacancy rates for the period commencing 30 April 2014 up to the first month of January 2015. And essentially we've clustered the departments into provincial departments and national departments. So if we look at the national departments, the average vacancy rate for national departments is at this point in time 7.32%. We must remember it's an average, so there are outliers that contribute to this. So some departments are doing extremely well with very low vacancy rates, and some departments have extremely exorbitant vacancy rates which actually are nullified by low vacancy rates. The Eastern Cape, Free State, Gauteng, KZN, and the other provinces, as you can see, it's largely the Free State has a 9.23% vacancy rate and the Western Cape. I must indicate that over time the department shifts. So in January, the Free State may look good, but come April, there might be another department and so on. So they shift continuously based on their local conditions in terms of turnover as well as recruitment and additional posts being created. However, one of the biggest concerns that emerges is that since April 2014, there has been a gradual increase. If you look at the last row, on the average has increased from 9.51 to 9.89 to 11.78 and then 14.25 as we sit now. And I want to draw a line at the point of September 2014. We must remember in September 2014 there was a constitution before that of a new cabinet. Departments were reconfigured, and many of them were separated, merged, or new departments created. And this macro organizing of the state has had an impact on filling of vacancies, because departments during the period in which they are dealing with macro organizing matters very often do not fill vacancies until they've finished with the technical issues around it. So we believe that, in our opinion, the period 30 September to 1 January was impacted by the macro organizing and probably will stabilize going forward, because in the provinces they also follow suit in terms of what the national orientation is towards the mandate of government departments and structures, so they tend to restructure concurrently with national departments. Chair, on the next slide is a brief summary, again using the same methodology, of the average vacancy rates, time to fill vacancies in the public service, and in terms of 1 April to 30 June 2014, that was one quarter, July to September of 2014, and October to December. So the three quarters that were in this financial year, we can see that there has been, in many cases, a decrease in the time to fill vacancies in some departments. However, in some provinces, there has been an escalation. It has been increasing. There are many attributes to that. In terms of the departments, what we've noticed at the provincial level, between 4 to 6 departments invariably in each province do very well. They either meet the target or they exceed it. So it fluctuates from department to department. The median time to fill vacancies in the public service over this financial year from April has been 5.87, reduced to 5.2 months, which is still within the target. We are hoping to get greater efficiencies going forward and are talking to departments and having workshops with them on how best to decrease this. Slide 8, Chairperson. The current trends. What we've noticed is that 41 departments during this period have reduced their vacancy rates in 6 months. So there is a commitment to address the targets. However, generally there is an average vacancy rate. And when we deal with the departments that have very high vacancy rates, you will see why it's affecting the general target, because they're so far out in terms of their percentages. The details of these departments are on the next slide, Chairperson, on page 9. This table shows the average vacancy rate that was more than 10%. And if you look at the middle column, you will see that at least 50% of the departments at national level did not achieve the percentage. Now, we take a very extreme view of the 10%. If you 10.01, you didn't meet the target. That data is not here, but this is a high-level summary. So some of the departments are actually very close to the 10%, but just fall on the wrong side of the track. the Eastern Cape shows that at least 70% of their departments are trying to, are meeting the target. Free State, Gauteng, Northwest, Northern Cape, and the Western Cape. Again, you can see that more than 60% of those departments in those provinces are failing to meet the vacancy rate. Now, if you look at the previous slide, you will see that some of these departments, provinces, have actually fallen within the target of 10%. So, indicative of these means that in some provinces, there are departments with a 2% vacancy rate and a 1% vacancy rate, which is bringing the vacancy rate to look low, but in actual fact, they are cross-subsidizing the performance of others, underperformance of others, and that's not acceptable. Because if you look on the right, the highest vacancy rates in these non-conforming departments are shown. And as you can see, one of the departments at a national level has a 37.5% vacancy rate. And that is largely attributed to decisions made at an executive and administrative level, and I will deal with those later, as well as the issue of freezing of posts. The Free State as well has an extremely high vacancy rate. There is one department with almost 69% vacancy rate. And Limpopo has a 45% vacancy rate. What we did notice, Chairperson, is that the vacancy rate in Limpopo during the intervention with National Treasury and other national departments was maintained. However, once the team under administration moved out, it seemed that the vacancy rate started to creep higher than 10. Chairperson, on slide 10, it's a breakdown of those departments that have not met the target. Again, of the national departments, 19 have met the target, and the ones that are of concern for us are the four departments that have vacancy rates above 20%. We are currently engaging with them to assist with some of their challenges, but our concern is that the Department of Sports and Recreation South Africa has the highest vacancy rate of almost 38%. I have shed light on the Limpopo Provincial Administration, where there was an increase from a very good target of 6.4% to an average of 24.4%, and we attribute that to many factors around the changes administratively in terms of the removal of the administration, as well as some of the decisions around the macro organizing and moratoria placed on posts. Of the 115 provincial departments, 43 departments have met the target, and 72 departments have vacancy rates higher than 10%. When we break down those 72 departments on slide 11, Chairperson, the ones that are of concern are the 12 departments that have vacancy rates above 30%. Especially the Free State Department of Social Development, which has a vacancy rate of 68.24%. Now, Chair, many of the departments of social development are usually combined with the departments of health and so on. So when macro-organizing takes place at a provincial level, there is either the separation of these departments or the merging of these departments, and they invariably impact on recruitment decisions. If we use the vacancy rate of 31 July 2014 as our last baseline, the departments listed below show a significant increase in the vacancy rates. And the sad part is some of them had been complying extremely well. National Department of Higher Education and Training has shifted from 8% to 14.5%. Northwest Office of the Premier has moved from 28 to 51. Limpopo Department of Health has moved from 3.18% to 45%. Social Development from 15 to 33.79%. And Chair, we've put those two there because they are related in terms of the configuration. It can be attributed to many factors at the provincial level. And the Department of Sports and Recreation, KZN, which has increased from 4.22 to 16.10. slide 12, Chairperson. We have shared with you the current median time to fill vacancies, and it's well within the target. And on this slide, we have a list of departments and categorizing the performance in terms of how long it has taken the worst departments in these provinces. At the national level, there's a department that takes 36 months to fill a post. That means over the entire MTEF that we have been measuring this vacancy, it has remained vacant. The same with the Eastern Cape, Free State, Limpopo, Northwest. Gauteng, 21.7 months, the longest vacancy that has been on the MTEF. KZN, almost 11 months. Mpumalanga, 15 months. Northern Cape, 12 months, and the Western Cape, 21.43. And Chairperson, if we look at the middle column, we see that at a national level, 41% of the departments have not met the six-month target. More than 60% or close thereon have met it. In the Eastern Cape, 30% of the departments have not met the target, with the worst one being a 36-month vacancy. Time to fill. The Free State, 41%. Gauteng, nearly half the departments have failed to meet the target. KZN, seemingly doing very well at around 77% compliance, with 23% not meeting the target. Limpopo, 27% of the departments not meeting the target. And those link directly to the Limpopo Department of Health and Social Development. Mpumalanga, 33% of the departments failing to meet the target. Northwest, 58%. Northern Cape, 27%. And Western Cape, 61% of the departments not meeting the target. Now, you will remember that one of the departments took 1.5 months to fill a vacancy. But more than 60% of those departments are failing to meet the target in that province. So the issue is there are extreme outliers and highly performing departments which are reducing provincial targets. Going forward, we will be reporting directly about those departments within the province that don't meet the targets. The median period to fill vacancies at the national level currently sits at 6.05 months. Of the 39 national departments on slide 13, Chairperson, 17 took longer than 6 months, with the worst period being 36 months to fill a vacancy. At the provincial administration, 7 administrations met the target of 6 months. The Northwest Provincial Administration had the longest median period of 10.62. So generally at a provincial level, 7 out of 9 provinces seem to be addressing the issue, though there are peculiar problems within provinces around outliers. On slides on page 14, we will be sharing with you the provincial departments that had the longest turnaround times. As you can see on slide 14, Chairperson, the Eastern Cape Department of Transport had vacancies for 36 months over the entire MTEF period, and that seems to be the norm for at least 5 of the departments there. Western Cape was 21.43 months, the longest vacancy. KZN, 10.98. In Mpumalanga, Sports, Culture and Recreation, 15 months. And Northern Cape, Cooperative Governance, almost 12 months. Now, in terms of these, Chairperson, we have been liaising with the departments. We are mindful of some of the challenges around recruitment. However, the DPSA, in terms of the MTSF, has taken a strategic approach in dealing with it, in so much so that the minister is currently looking at a uniform job grading directive. There's an issue of applying uniform or benchmark job descriptions, which will assist with the recruitment process. Regarding the restructuring or the constant restructuring of departments, the minister has indicated that he wants the directive amended to stabilize this so that restructuring should only take place under certain circumstances or at certain periods in time. And the DPSA is working on that. as well as looking at the directive on organizational design. That means when you develop an organization and you want to design a structure for your organization, the process has taken long historically. The minister has indicated that we need to look at greater efficiencies in the process and consultation with departments so as not to make it protracted. And the branch governance in DPSA under which this function resides is currently looking at amending the directive. In addition to assisting on these matters, in order to stabilize the 10%, the DPSA is also driving, and even through the MPAT process, the compulsory conducting of exit interviews to manage vacancies, and it's also looking at the issue of stabilizing the senior management service by setting minimum entry requirements into the public service. So you just can't parachute into the senior management service after doing 1 year as a director or 6 months into a director's position and then become a chief director and so on. So it set conditions of 5 years at a senior management service to move up the ranks. So Chairperson, that was on the vacancies. And the next aspect deals with the personal suitability checks. And I'll take you through that. In terms of the public service and the then MIA, you had to do pre-employment verifications. So in 2006, MIA submitted proposals to Cabinet around the introduction of a national vetting strategy for South Africa to enhance government vetting capacity at all levels of government. Now, following Cabinet's approval of this memorandum, the Minister of Public Service issued a directive to supplement the regulations that deals with the verification of candidate information prior to the appointment of the filling of a post. So you cannot appoint the person and then do the verification. It becomes an audit finding with the Auditor General. The directive took effect on 1 January 2008 and largely deals with the following areas. The verification around criminal record checks, citizenship verification, financial asset record checks, and this speaks to the issue of anti-corruption and doing business with government and understanding conflicts of interest, the qualification verification, and reference checks around previous employment. And Chairperson, through this circular, it was for departments to undertake this process in conjunction with the State Security Agency. And the State Security Agency would largely assist departments to conduct criminal record checks and do citizenship verifications with Home Affairs as well, assist departments to establish their own database and financial asset record and qualification checks, provide training and guidelines to departments to conduct prescribed verifications. On slide 18, Chairperson. The slide seeks to draw a distinction between the pre-employment checks and the vetting. As you are aware, the pre-employment verifications form part of the staff selection process and is mandatory. The outcome of that will influence your decision on appointment. The vetting function, however, screens persons for the purpose of security classification. Except for the appointments at the HOD level, the need for vetting rests at the discretion of departments, depending on the information you are privy to. So it's secret, top secret, confidential. The vetting function resides with the legislation of the minimum information security standards and are administered by state security, not by the DPSA. Now, Chairperson, the directive issued by the Minister of Public Service and Administration applies only to departments listed in the Public Service Act. It does not extend itself to parastatals and state-owned enterprises and state-owned companies. The personal suitability checks, including qualifications, are necessary to protect the state from a security perspective as well as the risk of potentially employing corrupt or fraudulent applicants. And so it's meant to be a significant screening mechanism in addition to the competency for the post. However, it must be noted that any delay experienced in finalizing the verifications has a knock-on effect on the department's ability to meet the 10% target. So in meeting the target, there are a number of processes that need to be aligned and completed within a set time frame. The DPSA, in supporting departments to meet outcome 12 targets, has engaged with State Security, the South African Police Service for the Criminal Records Check, and Department of Home Affairs to jointly explore processes to create greater efficiency in the personal suitability checks. And the Public Service Commission held a discussion with State Security, SAPS, as well as DPSA on how to create greater efficiencies and to remove obstacles or blockages in the system late last year. And what the DPSA is looking at is actually looking at coordinating and accessing information that becomes easier and more efficient. The discussions around vetting fieldwork units to establish issues around verifications in respect of temporary employment, such as casual workers and emergency staff. Chairperson, the State Security Memorandum does not exclude any type of employment. It's inclusive. So even if someone comes to work for you for 3 months, you've got to do a personal suitability check. And as you can imagine, the public service is in excess of 1.3 million people. It is a huge task to address. And we also want to discuss with State Security the rollout of training by the State Security Agency to departments on pre-employment checks, such that they can delegate the work to the departments and approve the final certificate. Slide 20 I've already discussed. It's just dealing with the key role players and the functions. Now, in dealing with the verification of qualifications, again, the Cabinet explored this position and took a decision that the Minister of Public Service should ensure that the state agency does the verification of qualifications. Now, how did this happen is historically the verification of qualifications were left to the department's discretion with private service providers. And Cabinet felt that, one, it was inefficient, it was not economical, that every department contract different service providers, there is no accreditation system for these service providers, and state information will be in the hands of privateers. That all this happens when we have an agency like the South African Qualifications Authority, which is mandated to do this work. So the minister then issued a directive to indicate to departments that the sole agency that should be doing verifications for the public service must be the South African Qualifications Authority. The South African Qualifications Authority had to develop a systematic process that was defensible in terms of quality assurance and verification of qualifications. Historically, when private service providers presented departments with a verification statement, departments just looked at the artifact. They did not question the process. How does a company verify a qualification? They just accepted the process. So now, in the discussions with SACO, we have a dedicated process. Departments know how it's done, and it's based on face value verifiable information, not through third parties. As part of the process, SACO initially undertook to do the bulk verification. In other words, government departments were to submit a list of all their employees and their qualifications to SACWA. However, we had very little success with that because not many departments took the bulk verification process forward, and it was a concern. And it actually affected the funding modalities for SACWA because they thought they would use the bulk verification funding to drive the verification process. And it had a direct knock-on effect. Now, in dealing with the verification, SACWA takes two processes. They have a National Learners Records Database, which has the qualification data of all citizens in the country that have come through the public, institutions that are registered and accredited in South Africa. And where it is on a database such as the NLRB, it is just a matter of a search function and you can find the records. However, where they have been challenged is knowing the disparate history in terms of our educational system. The pre-1992 educational data is a concern. Much of it is still paper-based. It's still based in old archival records in provincial departments of education. You will remember that many teacher education colleges and nursing colleges have closed, but those records are still resident with the provincial departments. So in verifying these matric or grade 12 results pre-1992 as well as qualifications from these institutions, SACWA has to physically send out personnel to go to these institutions and to trawl through their archives and to find the paper-based evidence and then digitize it. SACWA now, together with the Department of Higher Education and Training as well as Basic Education, is looking at a process to digitize our historical records so the process will be more efficient. In terms of the services provided by SACWA, SACWA has a defined set of services at a defined cost, and it drives its service offerings by indicating to departments what the cost is in terms of the turnaround time. What we have also succeeded to do with SACWA is that where an individual has already been verified, the qualification record has already been verified by SACWA, Madam Chair, when another department requests the verification, it's a matter of retrieval of the data, not a re-verification. And also SACWA does not charge for the same employee twice or applicant. It's a once-off payment to the state. Chair, slide 22. For the past year, SACWA has reported that they've verified 28,500 people's records. A record is one qualification. If an individual has two qualifications, it's two records. For that period, they've verified almost 30,000 records. Of the 30,000 records, Chairperson, they found 640 records where there was fraudulent representation or misrepresentation. Now, Chair, I must clarify. Misrepresentation is generally where a person has an incomplete qualification and they say incomplete PhD, but the department requests SACWA to verify the PhD, and SACWA says incomplete. That does not mean the person has proposed a fraudulent qualification. However, there are issues of fraud where people or applicants tamper with the certificate, change the date, change the year, change the name. These issues around fraud are then forwarded to the issuing institutions to take up as a civil matter. We have been informed by SACWA that the Minister of Higher Education treats the fraudulent or tampering with qualifications in a serious light and is driving a process to address fraudulent representation of qualifications in the higher education realm. Chairperson, of the national departments, 98% of them are using SACWA to verify the qualifications, and out of the 116 provincial departments, almost 50% are using it. So clearly some of the departments are not complying. We have raised this with the Auditor General, who deals with it as part of their regularity audits. And we have also engaged with these departments to find out why they are not doing it and how are they appointing the people. Chairperson, in sharing with you the three issues, I hope to highlight the issue that the target around the filling of vacancies is not about a number. It's about a strategic process that's actually impacted on by many decisions. In our engagements with departments, one of the issues they've indicated to us is that there have been ongoing long periods of restructuring that have affected their performance on the target. Very often, executive authority and accounting officers place moratoria on the filling of posts for extensive periods, either because they're reconfiguring or they are short of funds. And one of the key issues they've indicated is that there are insufficient delegations to full posts. Delegations are centralized at sometimes the highest level. So even if you want someone at level 1, someone at level 16 has to sign it off, and it's just inefficient. What the DPSA has done, Chairperson, is come up with a delegations framework, which has been workshopped with all the provinces, and to share with provinces that
it is important to delegate the work where it is happen, where it's the most efficient place to happen. Although we have the framework, there's no guarantee that every department will apply it at the level. The discretion is at the EAs in terms of the delegation. Chair, the issues around some of the scarce and critical skills and managerial vacancies is an issue. We are in competition with the public, with the private sector, especially for our professionals. However, there is a challenge as well, because in terms of the wage bill, departments have to make choices about what they can and can't afford. And it has a contingent impact on our vacancy rate. The delays in finalizing verifications by both the SACWA and the State Security Agency for a variety of reasons, historical or efficiency-wise, has a direct bearing on the meeting of targets. We at the DPSA have our ongoing meetings with departments to guide them to share best practice and also to get them to understand that it's more than playing the targets. Because if you don't have a sustainable process in recruitment, either at an operational level or a strategic level, you would meet the target in one quarter and fall off the radar in the next. You've got to look at a sustainable process. In addition, as part of the sustainability of the issue, we have worked with the National School of Government to develop programs on recruitment to support SRM sections in departments. And those are available and shared with departments to capacitate their units. In terms of DPSA's role with the third-party agencies of State Security and SACWA, I think they perform a unique and valuable service that cannot be replicated by external agencies. So we continue to engage with them to seek greater efficiencies. And we are hoping that with the discussions with Home Affairs and SAPS around this matter, we will be able to shorten some of the vetting pre-employment screenings. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I think let's take discussions, questions and comments. Then the 50% of employment of women in senior management services and the recruitment of the 2% people with disabilities then will follow. Okay. I think it's a different approach.
No, thanks. We thought it would be one presentation because it's from DPSA. Out of what you have presented in case of the recruitment, it also is a flow in case of the numbers that are we reaching the targets.
The presentation has got a lot of statistics which I'm not going to.
you, Honorable Chairperson and members. I will be talking to slide 21 of the presentation that we forwarded to the committee. I'm not sure, Chair, whether you want me to start from the beginning or you just want the part that DPSA was going to present now. Okay. Maybe let's start from the beginning, Chairperson, if you allow us. Okay. All right, the first slide. Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be talking to slide number 21 from our presentation, the PSC presentation, yes. Slide number 21. Actually, the first slide there is just giving a background that the basis for gender equity is outlined in the documents that are listed there, and I don't want to bore the members because they are the authors of those legislative frameworks that are listed there. I will just go to slide number 22, where it says the White Paper on Transformation of 1995 stated that at least 30% of new recruits to the middle and senior management echelon should be women. And the target of 30% for women served as recognition that there was a need for gradual change. And then the target was revised in 2007 by Cabinet to 50% to align it with the national, regional, and continental and international treaties. And then the 50% was retained in 2012 to be achieved in 2014. And then the next slide is actually showing the years and the percentage starting from 2004 up to 2014. And the second slide, actually the slide that I'm talking to Chair, show that these targets are still not met by the department. Despite improvements in the number of women employed since 2004, gender representation at SMS level, as set by Cabinet, has not been met by several departments by June 2014. And I think we are beginning to observe a slight, improvement in some departments, but in some still a decline. And then the equity targets for people with a disability on slide 26, we're just giving the background again, where we're talking about the Constitution and other legislative frameworks, and that these agreements are actually agreed to where South Africa is a signatory for following the international protocol, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disability. And then the 2% target for the employment of people with disability in the public service was set in 1995 through the White Paper on Transformation of the Public Service. The target was never changed to date. According to the Public Service Commission research, the number of people with disability employed in the SMS level increased from 0.4 in 2004 to 1.6 by June 2014. Although there is an improvement in this area, it must be noted that the statistics confirm that the recruitment and retention of people with disabilities remain a challenge which needs to be addressed systematically. A major challenge is the limited skills base as a result of a lack of educational opportunities for non-white people with disabilities. Serious interventions by national and provincial departments should be put in place and an assessment conducted to determine the reason why the public service is not meeting the target. The next slide is just showing the trends in the representation of people with disability from 1984 to June 2014. And we can see the graph there is going up and down sometimes. And then to conclude, Chairperson, the PSA engaged the DPSA and other relevant stakeholders to address some of the challenges in the human resource environment. It will continue to monitor and to engage with all relevant stakeholders to explore whatever solutions. With respect to employment equity, the analysis has revealed that the public service has performed relatively well in terms of transformation, transforming the gender and disability profile. However, a lot still to be done in order to achieve the 60% target for the employment of women at the SMS level, and also the 2% target for people with disabilities. There should be a concerted effort in implementing employment equity and affirmative action programs consistently to ensure continuous progress in meeting targets. Then the PSC will continue to monitor progress in this area and report to Parliament and the various legislatures. And in summary, Chair, we want to put in the House that these targets are not being met.
Let's do this. Can we get a presentation on this? Yeah. I think this is what statistics is doing. It's more important. Let's focus on that.
Thank you, Chairperson. By and large, we agree with the findings of the Public Service Commission. I would, however, like to suggest that when we look at slide 27 of the Public Service Commission and my slides on page 3 on persons with disability, the trends, it is important to note that our slide measures the trend according to the entire public service, which is what Cabinet requires us to do, and the PSC has rightfully focused on SMS only. That is why it looks like the figures differ, but it is because the focus of PSC was SMS, and our focus is on the entire public service. Thank you, Chair. The introduction, I'm not going to dwell on that, PSC covered it, but I would like to speak to the slide on page 2 that illustrates compliance for women at SMS. It is true that we have not met the required 50%, but I think when one looks at the slide, it begins to really show that between 1995 and where we are now, there has been a considerable progress. What is important for us to do is not to become complacent and make sure that those two figures in terms of men at SMS and women at SMS reach parity. The trends, as I said, for disability, which is the next slide, at the top of page 3, that also shows that having started at 0 point, and this 0 point I would like to explain in the context of the IFMS project. We all know that prior to IFMS, government was using the PASAL system, or still uses the PASAL system to capture the data. Now, government before 1994 used what we call the medical model in dealing with disability, and this model actually
did not allow disabled people to function in the public service. The medical model implied if medicine can't cure your disability, then you should actually be pensioned off or boarded medically. And that is why the statistics for disabled people in the public service before 1994 and up to now still remain problematic. What we are finding now is for this 2% to be an accurate reflection, officials with disability should declare their status. What happens on PASAL is if you enter that you have a disability, PASAL then starts asking you very different questions to any other public official. Your blood groupings and all sorts of things which an official that does not have disability would not be asked. We have received complaints from employees with disability in the public service that they will not declare their disability for as long as we have this process where they are treated differently and can be construed as a discriminatory practice. And secondly, some of the questions are found to be invasive of their privacy. Now, for us as a government, this is very important that we change it, because in terms of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability, it is a discriminatory practice. Between DPSA and Treasury, we tried to look at how we could change the situation. But PASAL is such an old system that when you enter changes, it does not capture it. And some of the changes we were wanting to introduce had been following consultation with the Department of Women, Children and Persons with Disability, which has now moved to Department of Social Development. So for us, the introduction of IFMS is a big step forward, because we will now be able to respect the rights of all public officials and not leave out the other group. In terms of the trend, although we have not met the 50% for women at FMS, we thought we would just like to share with the House some of the improvements and in fact an indication that it can be done if the departments commit themselves to achieving equity. So 23% of departments by December 2014 had in fact met the required 50%, and 29 departments had in fact met the required 2% for disability. And Gauteng province was in fact the province with the highest representation of women at FMS, standing at 44.4%, as well as representation of persons with disability at 1.28%. The next slide, Madam Chair, just illustrates how the different provinces and national departments have performed. Part of our monitoring involves the use of the Office of the Premier as the coordination point within the provinces. And for us, it's very important that if a province is to achieve, the Office of the Premier should in fact be exemplary. And here I would like to highlight on page 5, Gauteng province again, if you look at the performance of the Office of the Premier, red indicates that you did not achieve even half of the required target. For example, for gender, if you are red, it means you are below 30%, which takes us to pre-1994 era. And red for disability means you failed to achieve 1% of the required 2%. So if you look at Gauteng, Office of the Premier, there is no red. It's not perfect, but it's exemplary.
And the same would apply to Limpopo province, for example. It doesn't have any red, and it has a few greens. And some of the salient issues that I would like to speak to also, if you look at page 10 of this presentation, the two triangles, the one on the right shows you that women, rather on the left, women form the majority of public officials. And yet, when you look at the leadership, the men, you look on the right, the men predominate. So, although we have women above 50 in the public service, by and large, they occupy the lower positions. The higher you go in rank in the public service, the less the women become and the more the male becomes. And in fact, more detailed statistics, which we will be releasing later at the end of the financial year, will show that even this seemingly positive picture of 40-something percent, if you look at its spread, women continue to be at the entry level of SMS, which is director position. It still remains fairly good at chief director level, but once you move to the DDG level and DG, it gets less and less. For us in the public at DPSA chair, it has been very difficult to try and get departments to comply with the 50%. What we do, we continuously look for critical entry points to make an impact. For example, it has been very difficult to monitor the incidence of sexual harassment, and to develop a policy was equally tricky. It was very useful then for us in 2005 when the Public Service Commission released the report where they raised this as a serious shortcoming, that the public service does not have a sexual harassment. And we would like to report today that in fact this policy was developed last year. It has been circulated to departments, and we've given departments an opportunity to put systems in place for its reporting. So this coming financial year, 2015, is going to be the first financial year where departments are going to be required to report to the DPSA annually on incidents of sexual harassment. So we also can do with the pressure from the Public Service Commission, the Portfolio Committee, Civil Society, because these help us to put pressure on departments. Thank you. We also have another entry point that we have found very useful is the MPAT process of the Department for Monitoring and Evaluation. We got the department to introduce a key result area where departments have to report on their percentages according to the two equities. And what we have found is that now that departments have to report on equity in the MPAT, there is more seriousness. That is why the percentages that I shared a little while ago actually show a great improvement. With regards to disability, the trend slide shows that there isn't an up and down movement. The trajectory has always been upward. The big concern is that it is just so very slow. In engaging with departments, a lot of them informed us that the provision of reasonable accommodation for disabled people is one of the challenges. The DPSA after extensive consultation and again working with the Department of Women, Children and with People with Disability until last year, developed the policy on the provision of reasonable accommodation. This policy has been signed off by Minister Chabani last month. We are just planning to share it with Cabinet very soon. And once the policy has been released, we are also going to expect departments to report on how many officials in each department have in fact applied for reasonable accommodation, how many of them were provided, and how many were not provided, and what were the reasons, so that we are then able to intervene. We have also been asked by the portfolio committee last year to address some of the anecdotal statements that have been given that the public service is losing a lot of employees with disabilities. Our statistics and this trend slide actually shows that. The figures don't show that. What the figures show is that the movement is upward but slow. And there's a lot of playing musical chairs we see in the statistics. So we decided to do a study at DPSA to try and determine whether it is in fact true that disabled employees are leaving the public service, or are they in fact moving around, or is government not attracting disabled employees from outside, but rather choosing to poach from each other, which is a point that Jeeva has mentioned, that to what extent is the public service really addressing the unemployment by attracting new entrants instead of poaching from one another. That study is going to be completed at the end of this financial year, so the next round of reporting to the portfolio committee, we will be able to shed some light on whether, in fact, we are losing employees with disabilities or not. There is also another opportunity that we think might present itself for us around this area, and that is around the Public Administration Management Act. One of the projects that the DPSA is considering addressing is doing an assessment and an evaluation of the extent to which the public service is implementing the principles and values as espoused in the Constitution. And one of those principles speaks to the issue of transformation. So when one does an audit of to what extent is the public service attempting to create a public service that is fair and reflective of the people of South Africa, the equity data that we have will be able to provide that picture. And if the picture is serious and needs further injection of some bite, we may then ask the Minister for Public Service to issue a directive or something a little stronger than the Cabinet equity target. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. You need 2 minutes. Yeah, just 2 minutes. Let's take a break for 2 minutes. Then we'll come back for questions. Yeah.
Thank you. what is the more important is that they take action from their members.
Okay.
Because the person only needs to present something risk by himself and to his or their own analysis.
Sorry?
The person who, the presentation,
yeah.
The person can do his or their own analysis.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if he wants to risk that?
Hmm?
If he wants to risk
that? Yeah. Presentation of going to say so just take important information about the presentation. And the person can finish one reading within himself.
Okay.
Mm. Thank you.
Randomly, we're not going to follow the pattern of presentations. We're not going to follow the presentations, but we'll just ask questions. And my first issues are on people with disabilities and recruitment of women in senior positions. What is it that needs to be done to actually enforce this decision of recruiting people with disabilities and women? You know, I once served in JSC, where we recruit judges, and one of the main issues was to transform and was to deal with transformation, mainly bringing women into senior positions. And you know where presidents, of course, will come and say, I was unable to get women. We'll then simply say, we're not considering your court. Go back. Train those women. If they are there, get them trained. Give them, what is this, the acting opportunities and all that, you know. What is it that can be done in public service? Because, you know, even the president spoke about this in many occasions, recruitment of women and all that. It's like a promise that we are unable to. Is it achievable? That's one thing that we need to also maybe check whether that is achievable or not. I also note what you said about people with disabilities. Could that mean we do have people in the system, but because of the reasons that you said, the person system asks them different questions and they are not comfortable to be disclosing? Could that mean that we do have maybe more people? But I've seen, you know, like Woolworths, they do have people with disabilities and all that, you know. It's so interesting. I mean, those are small companies compared to public service and government itself. I think we can do far better than them. So, do we have a commitment from departments? Well, I'm happy that departments where we conduct oversight directly, for an example, National School of Government is doing well. What else is doing well? Public service is also doing well. Planning, monitoring, and evaluation, not, and the president as well, they're not doing that well. But those are the issues that we will then be dealt with by the committee. But I just wanted to highlight that. With regard to the first presentation and the second one, I want to know the wage bill. The budget, the Minister of Finance, one of the challenges that he raised was the high wage bill. Where are we? Where are we sitting at? If you can maybe clarify that for us as to where are we. And the system, we understand the IFMS system is a pilot project, and it has taken you almost 9 years to roll it. What are the cost implications so far? Is there value for money? Is it also assisting in terms of combating fraud? You were very silent on that. You also said the vanilla solution, I don't know if I understood you correctly, you said it means that you need to keep it as if. You don't have to expand, because the more you expand, then it means more cost. It has got more cost implications on maintenance in particular. Who does the maintenance? And if you don't improve, if you don't improve it, will it not open up for fraud and corruption? And also migrating from one solution to the other, you know, in most cases it creates problems. Have you encountered any unintended consequences where people would be maybe paid twice or three times more than what they're supposed to get? And then if that happens, then how do you deal with that? Because I'll also be happy. 1 month you just get paid double. But I know if money are put to you, that if it is money that is not due to you, you will have to pay it back, you know, and that's also sometimes if people have spent the money, you know, have you ever encountered that? The departments that are unable to reach, you said, oh, okay, let me refresh you this way. You said we have how many, 115 government departments? 160. And 1.3 million employees. And then only 19 met the target of feeding of police. Am I correct? Nationally. But it's still little. Yeah. It's unacceptable. Because of the PEM Act that is coming, we'll be shifting people again, you know, seconding people and all that. So what does that mean? You know, it means, I don't know, it's unacceptable. It goes back to what I said earlier on. What is it that needs to be done in making sure that we recruit, we fill vacancies within the required time? Because if a vacancy is unfilled for 2 years, it impacts on service delivery. Maybe those departments that are not doing well, we will have to call them to come and around to the portfolio. We will have to, maybe we just have to prioritize 5 of them. They must come and follow up to come and. In fact, personally, I feel that those posts are supposed to be filled by women and people with disabilities. That's why they're telling in terms of filling those projects. I mean, not projects, those posts. So I think we need to do that. If a post is not filled, then what happens in the meantime? Do you have a person who's acting or just left vacant like that? And then what could be the most contributing factor for non-filling of posts? Is it internal squabbles or people trying to do wrong things, or is it lack of capacity within departments? What is the main contributing factor? Verification or qualifications? At what stage are we going to be able to
vet people and check their verifications as and when they enter the public service. I think if maybe we can devise a model that can then assist government to then vet people as and when they enter public service, so that later on we are not embarrassed that people have failed qualifications, people had fraud or corruption cases, that they, you know, because those things, they do come up as and when people move within the system, they do discover such things. The SAPA and the state security, do they have capacity to deal with all the referrals that are? Because if you look at this, page 22, if SAPA to date has only completed 28,562, if it has only conducted 28,562 verifications, as opposed to 1.something million, it shows that they will never get there. So it is clear that we still need departments to conduct their own verification and bring consultants. There's nothing wrong with them using private companies or consultants, so that we try by all means to verify and vet everybody, especially people who are in senior management, so that we move away from this embarrassment that we come and again go through. I will pause for now. McGrew made a request that he wanted to be the first. Has he left already? Because he wanted to leave. I will start with him. Okay. All right.
Thanks, Chairperson, and my apologies. Maybe, Chair, I would like to start with the reports by nature, just as a comment. I must also say it's very difficult these last days for me to digest reports presented to the committee. And you will see later the reasons why I'm saying that. I do understand that most of the report is high-level stuff, and to some extent, I would appeal in future, you know, for presenters to put some little bit of meat to enable us as public reps, you know, to do our work rightfully, as you have said, that we as a committee must also be empowered or in a position to engage with these departments. Because what I see as far as the trends is concerned when it comes to reports, it's just a report, there is no action, no recommendation whether Mr. Van Niekerk of Eastern Cape Kouga Municipality has been fired because of non-compliance. There's nothing of this nature that we see. I think once we're going to engage and start into that type of firework, we will get the department and the public service really ahead. Also, I just want to make a comment on the very first page on the introduction, which is actually to me an indictment to the department as far as the cabinet decision to achieve the 50%. And the very first line says, across all levels has not been met. So it doesn't come with some sort of suggestions as the how part, how are we going to solve, and how are we going to resolve the issues. I also want to speak to the case in point, the IFMS. We take note of the fact. It is for very, very long. I would like to hear the responses that, yes, it is because of the amalgamation cooperation between various departments within. But I'm actually interested, while this project has been piloted, I would like to know where has it been piloted, and also if there were successes. As a public rep, I want to know. As an opposition member of parliament, I want to know so that I can also bring the roses where people need these roses. I also want to know where are the weak spots. What is happening so that we can see from our side whether we can do something, and also the challenges
when this pilot project has been implemented in the specific areas. Obviously, there were difficulties. It has been mentioned about Treasury, DPSA, CETA. I take it for granted the fact that we are trying so hard and so long to get this running. I take it for granted there was difficulties in terms of policy-related issues. I would like to know what was that challenge and how best was it resolved on that specific areas. Then, Chair, I want to speak on the vacancy rates. Mentioning has been made about outliers. Yes, I do agree. I'm really interested in the provinces who are party to that outliers. Who are the outliers? What are they? Who is involved as far as the outliers is concerned? And then also the relationship between the variables. Whether that relationship, when you look at the outliers, whether it is strong, whether it's moderate, and whether it is weak as well. I need some little bit of meat on far as far as the vacancy rate is concerned. We also take note that the vacancy rate as we have it creates a platform for a ghost employees. It not only creates a platform for ghost employees, it also affects quality of service. And quality of service, when you look at the incumbent, are we getting enough from the incumbent who is for time being in that position? It also affects the current incumbent. It affects quality service. Now, my question now is, how are we dealing with it? Looking into the contrast as far as the negative effect is concerned. Yes, stats are nice, and it's nice also to break the stats down. But I think as a department, we also do have measures to have people accountable. Now, when it comes to these vacancy rates, it has been mentioned that in various spheres or departments, there are directors and whoever, they don't comply in filling those. So what are we as a department do to have those people responsible, having them accountable? And I think that's not the only reason that has been mentioned as far as this vacancy rate is concerned. There are also capacity challenges. There are also incapacity challenges as far as the vacancy rate is concerned. Now, I would like to know what measures has been taken to have these positions filled, and also with specific reference whether there has been action against the culprits who is leaving that vacancy rate open. And I want to deal with the question of vetting of qualification. We talk about 640. Be as it may, I get it, it's not a secret. I would like to know who are these individuals. I am happy with the other explanation in terms of PhDs and whatever it happens. Are these individuals blacklisted? And then also, there's a cost. We're talking about recovering of money. What are the amount of money that we as a department has recovered thus far? I would like that amount to make known to us, and then also the total cost of misrepresentation. We have people doing all of these. We have people who do their work. There's a lot of money that goes along and balances this. It has also been mentioned that we do have 1.3 million of workers. So 30,000 of these vetting has been done on them. What are the time frames, or what is the department going to do to make sure that the other 1.1 million plus people will be vetted? Because I still believe that we do sit with some credible people within the system that have the right pedigree, that they have the right credentials. I still believe that there are also people that has faked their qualifications. So once we are going to get these people out of the system, I think then it's only when we can take the department forward. Then I would like to speak to, I think it's page 24, of the presentation regarding the gender equity targets. Again, it says here that despite improvements in the number of women employed since 2004, gender representation at SMS level, as set by Cabinet, has not been met by several departments. Who are these departments? Where are they? We would like to know, as members of Parliament, what has been done to address this? Was this addressed in the specific departments? We don't want to fall into a trap, relating all of these things into questions via Parliament. And I don't see it very fruitful for a department coming and do such a presentation talking about several departments. Again, would like to emphasize that I take note of the fact that it's high level, but to a certain extent that I feel that we as the public must be entitled to know who are the departments so that we can take some visits and see how best we can help them. As the portfolio committee, we decided that we are going to, after reports of this nature, calling the various respective people to address, to engage with them, or either go to them and find out what the problem is. It further states that this could possibly be ascribed. Possibly. So is this a true reflection of what has been found on the ground, or has someone remote control information as far as this is concerned, possibly ascribed to limited skills? If there are limited skills, what are those limited skills being found on the specific area where there's a lack of commitment to reach the targets? So in actual fact, it is a non-statement when it comes to that. And what is the problem that we cannot get to the bone of this? We have to get to the bone of this, and I think we have to name and shame these departments. You are the guardians, you are the overseers as a department in their respective sub-departments, and I think it's important for you to give us that information, filter that information through to us, so that we as members of Parliament also can endeavor into a program to see how best we can assist to have these people around the table or rather go to their premises and solve this problem of the country. Thank you.
Okay, let me do this. Perks, number two, followed by Lisoma, and then Kado, Madau, West Hazen, and
thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Thank you so much. Honorable Chairperson, I serve on the Portfolio Committee for Women in the Presidency. And by the way, I'm the only man in the whole committee. And I just get the impression, because you deal with these issues, including the economic empowerment of women, upliftment of women, and stuff like that. And I just get the impression sometimes that there's no work on the path of officials to actually, departments, to actually drive and implement what we are requesting them to do. When I read this report of the PSC on page 24, there's a statement there, bullet 2, that says this could possibly be ascribed to a limited skill base. Now, that is a serious problem, a statement. Exactly as what you said when you were sitting on the interviewing magistrates and judges, where people come to you and say they can't find women. Now, when you come and say there is no, perhaps it's ascribed to limited skill base, I personally do not believe, and I think the stats also show, there's no limited skills for women in this country. When you go to the higher learning institutions in the country, see the number of females that are enrolled and studying there. So we can't come and make a statement like this here, because that's where the problem starts, when we start making statements like this here. That it seems like it's a lack, there's not enough skills, there's plenty of skills. The problem is the will to implement. And I don't believe it's unconstitutional if you advertise a vacancy for the senior manager, where you, and I've never seen an advertisement, where you very clear that you are looking for female candidates. Like you say, we want disabled candidates. I think you're looking for female candidates to discourage these thousands of men from applying. Because that will discourage these thousands of skillful women from applying, because they know that they will have to compete with these thousands of men that will, they will be interviewed by a panel consisting mainly of males. Now, yeah, maybe you can say, my honorable member has said there's discrimination. I don't think it's discrimination, and I don't think it's unconstitutional, because you are saying there's a law that says we must meet at 50% target. You are already oversubscribed by men in the department. So why don't you just make the matter simple and say we are looking for a female candidate? Because that's what we want to do. We need to drive this thing. We must be more focused. We must drive it. And as I said, I just get a feeling there's not enough willpower to implement. But having said that, I don't think also we must just criticize ourselves, because as the ruling party in this country and in this parliament here, we've come a long way, and we have done a lot of good work. We have shifted things, we have changed things. We have put in mechanisms in place to ensure that we empower women, that we empower people with disabilities. So we shouldn't just, while I'm saying this here, on the other hand, we must also say that, yes, we have done a lot in the last few years to try and change things in this country. And this is the last year on the issue of verification of qualification. Although we are saying, we all agree, say the percentage is very, very low, but we have done a lot. So firstly, we must acknowledge that us, we the ANC government, that have put these mechanisms in place to try and root out this corruption. Because we don't want a situation where we put these mechanisms in place to the ANC government, and then when we expose these things, that tomorrow media turns around, and when they print in the media, then they want to portray like the ANC government is corrupt. Yet we are the ones to put mechanisms in place to try and change things around. And this problem is not of our making. This problem is not of our making. We are trying to change a problem that we have inherited because of the sunset clauses. You must understand, when we took over this country, the Bantustan government, how many people, officials we have inherited from Sky, Transkei, or Putoswana? All those kind of officials came into the system. And this was not our making. This was absolutely not our making. We inherited them, they before 1992. We must now verify their qualifications. They were not employed by us. And the very same people that were responsible for bringing them in the system in the first place are still pointing fingers at us now. And we are trying to clean up this mess here. So I'm saying, why are you not happy with what has happened? Or why are you not happy with the program? We're also saying that you should not just condemn ourselves and say we are not doing anything. The departments are working, they are putting systems in place, they are trying to get to grips with the situation. Thank you. More can be done.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Let us welcome the presentation, the whole four presentation. Because at least we know what we are dealing with. Chair, I'll just make an example of treasures, the usage of technology that sometimes are very dangerous if they are not explained. The fruitless expenditure. It doesn't say that why it becomes fruitless expenditure. For a layman who say that, hey, government has stolen money, this ministry, these officials and so forth, whereas you didn't budget for it, it's not in your plan, you have just redirected the funds without any prerequisite in terms of the documentation and everything. I'm leaving it at that in terms of some of the issues. Check. No. I totally agree, but the disadvantage of that for the public, it gives a different connotation, and the people, they kind of fund over there without a pre-understanding what informs that so much of fruit. Chair, what I would like to hear, which let me just appreciate through your good self, Chair, that we are forcing all these departments, M&E and DPSA, to work together. I and I hope they are not going to work together when they are coming for presentations, but issues that we are going to raise, they will go back and work as a collective in terms of mitigating those issues and improve thereof what we are expecting. You raised the issue of capacity. I would like also under the IFMS program, the capacity of seekers. I'm quite aware, subject to correction or confirmation, that CETA is not playing a meaningful role or substantive role as before from the 10 years back in terms of what is expected from them. But I would like to get the appreciation of the capacity, and I hope the capacity is well understood in terms of financial and technical, not the warm bodies, because they are warm bodies. Secondly, around capacities, also of PSC, its capacity. But also, Chairman, let me quickly say that I would have loved all the presenters to say what do they want from us, not only presenting the information, because there must be something that you want from us, other than us calling, as the Chairperson has said, that we will be inviting the prioritized department in terms of their low appetite of responding to our to the country's policy. The other one in terms of ISMSCAS is the issue of the domestic technical service providers, as you may call them. I know that the bulk in terms of producing the ICT equipment, we don't have that capacity, but there is a role from where I'm sitting that we can play in terms of developing the programs and all that, noting the process in terms of how far it is now. I would like also to get a sense of confirmation, also dealing, although we're dealing with human HR management systems here, but also does it respond to what the Minister has said in terms of the centralized supply chain? Because our systems, what we seek to address is for the systems to talk to each other where possible in its totality. Chair, in terms of the vacancy, filling of vacancies and non-filling of vacancies, the redundant vacancies and budgeted vacancies and those are that, you don't care whether you need to fill them or you need to abolish them. It's the issue of the decline and intake of young people and the retention thereof of young people. That you have spoken to people living with disability at a men's chair. But also, I didn't say it, I hear it up front in terms of DPSA, in terms of KPIs, in setting that in KPIs in terms of recruitment of women and people living with disabilities. By the way, people living with disabilities are not the ones only on wheelchair. There are various categories. So if we talk about people living with disabilities, talking in totality, as it may, we would be very interested in terms of equity targets when we assess performance of senior management in terms of compliance with the equity targets as expected. Chairperson, the other one in terms of, because if we say also our intake in terms of people living with disabilities, women, in particular people living with disabilities, our institutions user friendly for them to be recruited, and what is our role and our relationship with the learning institutions at all levels, technicals, your FETs, and also an entry level in terms of schools and all that, because that's where it starts. We are expecting the results, but also in terms of the foundation, we are not looking at whether the foundation is being laid to prepare those individuals to be also to be absorbed as it may, Chairperson. The rest, I will leave it to hopefully the response that you have in terms of the question that you asked in terms of the budget that was used, and also which areas, if possible, can you quantify in money terms, which areas are you going to get or use to this migration now from the previous exercise that you embarked on? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I've got a number of questions about the IFMS and then one about qualifications. Firstly, IFMS was conceived in 1998 and then approved by Cabinet for the first time in 2005. We're now down the line, and that constitutes 10 years of missed opportunities or inefficiencies that would have been enabled by an integrated financial management system. So my question was, what was the problem? Why those series of false starts and delays? Was it a lack of political will and leadership? If not, what was it? And secondly, how much did the first IFMS project cost before a decision was made to scrap it and to move to a commercial off-the-shelf solution? Because press reports in January suggested that the figure was as much as 1 billion rand. If that's true, how much of that 1 billion rand is available to be reinvested in the new project? The same press report suggests that it's as little as 10%. Has the rest been written off? How much will the new IFMS project cost? Thirdly, what are the legal repercussions of the new tender? Will CETA manage to negotiate its way out of contracts with service providers before the new tender is awarded to a single company? Fourthly, on the tender itself, the first time CETA advertised this tender in the 2013-14 financial year, it only attracted two bidders, I recall, one from India's 3i Infotech South Africa company and one from SAP. Again, as I understand it, the current IFMS tender is only open to software vendors or original software manufacturers, which precludes a whole bunch of service providers from participating. Is that interpretation correct? Then fifthly, could you shed some light on an earlier story that had to do with CETA and a tender that I understand was part of this IFMS project, and that was something which related to a PwC report which found that a single source appointment of ICT Works and the Simunier Consortium was recommended back in 2011 as part of the IFMS project, and that this constituted a deviation from the tender process. It went against Treasury instructions. CETA had initially awarded a separate related contract worth 700 million rand to those two companies, which never completed their duties. Could you just shed some light on how that fits into current IFMS? And then lastly, we seem to have a major problem with fraudulent qualifications in the public sector in South Africa. Now, either our verification process is deeply flawed, or SACW isn't up to the job, or we just don't care about fakes. Because, as we all know, a number of fake qualification stories have made headlines in recent years, including those of the SABC Chief Operating Officer, Claudia Tseneng, the former chairwoman, Helen Shabalala, and just this week we heard of two incidences where our new ambassador to Washington is in possession of a fake qualification, and our ambassador to Japan also claims to have a doctorate from a defunct fly-by-night institution. What exactly is the extent of this qualifications crisis in the public sector? What is being done about it? In 2010, if I'm not mistaken, DPSA ordered all state agencies to conduct a verification exercise. What was the outcome of that? How many fakes are there per department? Who are they? Are they still on the payroll? How much are they getting paid? I would like to get a very, very clear, concrete sense of the depth of this problem. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have a number of questions, so but I will do something. Just one question from each of the presentations. The first thing has to do with what my colleague Mark was talking about, the what I call the if-must thing. Any system, any new system that is being implemented as an improvement on an old system tends to be done for several reasons. One of the first reasons is cost-effectiveness, efficiency, and smartness, and all of those kinds of things. But an underlying factor in that whole approach is that those things tend to go with headcount losses. In other words, people lose their jobs. Now, we have been told that there are 25,000 users of the personal system. Question is, how many people will issue I want to raise has to do with qualifications and how people get employed and they work in there. But I'll use an anecdote. Recently, we read of a guy who was a convicted criminal who walked into a police station up north and presented himself as a senior detective. And all he had to do was tell the guys, I'm from head office. Nobody checked him out. Nobody did anything. They gave him a desk, and he worked, and they gave him a car. They gave him all sorts of things. How can something like that? How can something like that? And this is facts, right? Okay, now, my last issue has to do with gender equity. I hope all the women in this country yesterday were screaming as you were watching Parliament, right? Because yesterday, Parliament struck a blow against gender equity with the appointment of the head of the IEC. Because clearly, this is related to the questions we are asking. Why is it that we're not reaching this 50-50? My point is, if Parliament, when it has an opportunity, doesn't do it, what message are we sending to the department? That they may not do it.
Okay, can I call it for an order? Can I really request the member to focus on the presentation matters, not on the issues that happen in the House?
Well, they are related, because we as custodians of the Constitution have to make sure that the departments do what they're supposed to do and what especially the ruling party say they must do. But if the ruling party says, and I use ruling party because one of my colleagues used it, I would never use it, I would say governing party, says we need to have 50-50% representation and we have an opportunity to do it and we don't do it, what message are we sending? So I'm just saying that yesterday, unfortunately, we struck a blow against gender equity with the IEC, and I hope that the president will reject that recommendation and send it back to Parliament so that we can recommend somebody else. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to link on to what my colleague Cardo has asked regarding the commercial of the self tender. Can I just ask, can we get an indication of the budget implications of this purchase for phase one as well as going forward? Then secondly, over the last 10 years, surely there must have been a lot of fruitless expenditure in first exploring this alley, then implementing that pilot, then etc. Can we get an indication of how much money has been spent on the over the last 10 years in the development of this system? Then also, when you buy an off-the-shelf system, it still needs to be tailor-made or panel-beaded to fit your requirements. Who will be responsible for this, and what is the resources available for this? And then, lastly, two more questions. What domain, is a term that you've used in your presentation, what domain will first be implemented and rolled out and tested? And lastly, in terms of the training, one can look at all the disadvantages of an existing system, but one of the advantages is that people normally understand it and they are able to use it, and they've already developed some workarounds for some problems, etc., etc. When do you think will that training be able to happen? What are your planning? What are your budgets in that regard? And when can we start seeing the results of this whole exercise? Thank you. If I may just ask, one of the problems with vetting, to go to the other presentation, is the enormous delays that people have experienced with vetting of senior officials, etc. What are the plans in this regard? Is it still a problem, and can we expect a solution in that regard soon? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sure one needs to start by saying thank you to all the presenters. The preparation, the documents, I was quite impressed with the document from the PSC. I'm referring to this document which has got recommendations, and I hope that the department, as recommended by the PSC, will follow what has been said to them. Honourable Chairperson, I would like to start with IFNS. I thought I was going to get a mandate on the first page as to when they were established. Doesn't matter who established them, but when they were established. They were established under what proclamation? What was their mandate? Was there a problem with the SETA handling what was expected, what they were doing? Was there a problem? Maybe I'm asking the question to the wrong people, but they have to answer me because they are on the administrative side. And two, the establishment of this unit and with the 1 something billion allocated to it, you don't see the programs that are aligned with the allocation, with the money allocated. And that gives a problem to the money bill. You cannot allocate so much of the money where the money is supposed to follow the program. Three, its establishment, to me, is creating some duplication of some sort, which the government of today is saying is avoiding duplication of services within itself. Four, Chairperson, ISMS, I'm sure it's an HOD or an HOD, is saying this unit, it needs a highly, you know when somebody says highly, highly skilled technical professionals. That's what is serious problems with that Chairperson. Because this country, one is faced with a brain, what do you call this? When the private sector takes our people that have changed to them want to, it is faced with scarcity of human resources. Now, we develop a unit knowing very well that it needs highly. Do you have those people? Have you developed those people? What is the gender that is going? What is the representativity within that? Chairperson, you know, I'm trying to understand the sector here, and I'm trying to understand the IFMS, and I'm trying to understand the National Treasurer. I'm taking this anger, and I'm saying, I wonder what drives the National Treasurer. Maybe the National Treasurer needs to tell us, what was the problem that you actually came with this decision of establishing the IFMS? What did you want it to achieve? Where are the problems? So that you're able to do an oversight. Our job is to do an oversight. We need to do an oversight. We can't do an oversight on a blanket statement that you're going to ensure that, in fact, it's one of the things that you're going to do, that so yes, that you gave it to us. From there, Chairperson, I will go to the PSA. DPSA, I think they've got a lot to do. I do understand they're only there for 20 years. But you need to move with a very fast speed. The first question that you are still sitting with it as this committee is, what kind of a model, if you have not got another two to say, what kind of a model that you are using to determine the number of, or to establish a number of vacancies, funded vacancies for a particular department? Because, why I'm saying this, we might say we have got so much vacancies because the motive that is being used is wrong. We might say we have got enough stuff because the motive that we are using is wrong. That is now from all spheres of government. It could be national, it could be provincial, it could be local government. What kind of a model are you using when you establish funded posts? Where is the retention strategy that you have recommended for departments so as to stop the brain drainage to private sector, especially for positions which we know that is a scarce within our country? Where is the retention strategy? To this day, we don't have PPG. Now, it's even worrying that we don't even have a policy that is telling us about the entry level. And on the other side, the president and his executive is saying we need to create jobs. One of the objectives of in this country is creation of jobs. But we don't see the policy that is leading us towards the... When we advertise, we look at the Sunday Times, the advertisement by our department. It's about 5 to 6 experience. What about the kids that have just left the school? What about an accountant that is still writing articles? That is, what about an accountant that is still writing exams with the board? Where is the policy that is guiding us and say, indeed, there is a proper intake of our children, irrespective of the color? Where is it? Now, how do you expect us to monitor that you are doing the right thing? And we are running short of time. Indeed, Britain turn around in 100 years, but you can't be saying you just want to also wait for 100 years. Now, the chairperson talk about the 19 out of 39. When a student to me gets 19 out of 39, I always say you are fake. Now, the digitizing is a problem. I don't understand why. It could be whatever, yeah. I qualify that. I'm from nursing. Yeah? I qualify, I can't even remember whatever year. But there's a council. There's a nursing council. Why can't you get the database there? It is just as easy as getting to the nursing council, get the database. Go to the provinces. I come from KwaZulu-Natal. I didn't write my matric and my list. I don't know what was it. Mrs. Nzimande, what was the kind? It was Bantu, whatever. Yeah, but you're going to get it. The only thing you need to do is to employ people that are going to do proper filing just for a month. File them in each and every district. Just file and capture. Why are you making a problem when there is no problem? It's a matter of using money that is there, employ gifts, whatever it comes, and do the just simple filing. The matrix, they can do the simple filing. Capture them. And they're coming to us, you are coming to present the problem. There's no problem, PPG. Now, what I've just said to the DCSA, I want to align it with what was said by the PSC. The PSC, I'm not going to talk about the capacity, it's a family provider about the verification. The PSC has put it so clearly in its recommendation. It says there is no capacity to SSA. And I'm lucky that I know that there is no capacity. The PSSA says again, you know, this bulk verification, it actually delays the employment time frame. It also says there is a problem with the delegation of framework. This is what the PSC is saying. Now, the PSC, if this is what it's saying, what is the PSC? What have we done about it? Because they actually say they have the strategies.
But it is not coming out here. It is still coming out from the PSC as a problem, and there is no intervention. So can we then tell us exactly what is happening? There is no capacity in the SSA. Now, what is an alternative solution to that? Because for us to, one of the honorable members actually said, this government took the problems of the segregation of the province. The province was divided in so many things that you don't know. And as a result, they're doing their own thing. Yes, that is a problem. It is a serious problem. But you might tell us those problems. This is what you have found out. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be told in the house that we have employed the woman, the man instead of the woman. If we have employed a woman like Suzanne, who doesn't have the qualification to be an IEC, they are still going to complain again because we did not develop our women. Women were left behind when it was the man that needs to be developed. So can then be told us as to what is the problem in place to bridge that gap? And thank you, Chair.
Thank you. As your response, also come up with proposals as to what needs to be done. So that if there are issues that you are proposing, then we can see how do we then take them forward. Maybe proposing legislation or policies. So come up with proposals. Okay.
Thanks, Chair. There are quite a number of questions, but we'll request the CEO of CETA to start first because he's got a present matter to attend to. And then after that, we'll be able to answer other questions that are for. But in case of the statistics where we don't have right numbers, we will prefer that we'll write back to the committee to say these were the questions that were asked, but in case of the right statistics, we did not have the right answer. Like the wage bill is a sensitive thing in case of the negotiations now. So we really want to give a proper information with regard to the wage bill to say how much is it. So we'll request that we can write to the portfolio committee to say this is so much so that it become confidential in case of dealing with the negotiation thing. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. And committee members, thank you very much for the engagement.
Talk about the wage bill. What is confidential about it?
We are saying we will release the information, but we want the correct figure so that it should not be wrong, so that when we engage at the labor or at the caucus, it should be them not using the advantage of saying this is so much, only to find out we did not provide the correct information.
So, Chief, also want to add that it is a confidential matter because Dasmbovo's recommendations will actually get involved. Exactly. I'm saying the recommendations, he is right by saying it's still a confidential matter because the president has appointed Judge Ngobo to look at the wages. So whatever the outcome of that will also be calculated within the bill. I think is what you want to be saying there.
Thank you, Chair. The IFMS project as presented has been driven by DPSA, National Treasury and CETA. So there is a number of questions that the colleagues will be able to answer. However, there are specific questions that I think I should address from a CETA perspective. As raised by committee members, and the first one is that I think the presentation did address the issue of the origins of the IFMS, the vision that government had at the time to have this integrated financial management system, and I think the colleagues from the Treasury will provide a little bit more detail on that. The project as conceived then was going to be about 8 different systems that would then be pulled together to an integration, and then CETA would play a role of putting these systems together. Now, that decision at the time obviously was informed by what was happening around in other governments around the world as well. So it wasn't then, if you go back, because hindsight is always better, if you go back to that time, it wasn't necessarily a decision that was out of the ordinary in terms of what was happening. However, that decision, as we then learned over the years, had the potential of, one, creating challenges when it comes to pulling the information together as different systems evolve, not at the same time, and then to keep pulling together those systems so that they talk to each other. That would create costs that would undermine the benefits that would be derived from having an integrated financial management system. But also, the progress in implementing that had been had challenges. One, CETA needed to be a primary system integrator, which meant that CETA needed to have had some investments in the area of systems development and so on that would make it ready for that. We all understand that CETA as an institution has had serious problems over the years, and that objective wasn't met. Now, with that dynamic, and the fact that we need to pull together the systems, it just makes the potential of the costs to be much, much bigger. But some years down the line, as the STEERCOM, we then had to evaluate. We're 10 years down the line from the original decision. There were a number of projects that had been done. Some had been completed, some had not been completed. We had to evaluate whether the original ambition, the original vision, was going to be realized. And we came to the conclusion that that wouldn't be the case. Now, once you've made that determination, it would then be inappropriate to proceed down the same path when you are, in fact, have established and determined that this is not going to give us the benefit that we're looking for. And then Cabinet had to take the resolution that it took. Now, there's a question that keeps arising around whether expenditure incurred up until that point would be fruitless expenditure. I think a careful reading of the PFMA would say something different. It's a failed project, yes. Now, was money spent in vain necessarily? I don't think so. And this is a point that we've engaged with. But I think the colleagues from the Treasury and DPSA will talk about what was achieved, and that which was achieved, how can it be utilized at this point? So when we then come to the project that we're dealing with, there's a question around CETA's ability to deal with that, and there's a question around, I think one member raised the question of is CETA playing a meaningful role. I would put it this way. CETA is playing a different role than the role that it was playing in the previous project. In the previous project, we had to play the role of primary system integrator. In the current environment, we've got a vanilla system. There is no need for such a role because you're buying a composite system with all of the elements integrated already. So the role that CETA plays is very, very different from the other role. Is it meaningless? Is it meaningful? I don't think it's a question of it being meaningful or meaningless. It's a question of a role being different because the architecture that we're dealing with is a different architecture. We then have the capacity to respond to the demands of the project. Yes, we do. Can the project be delivered quick enough? The very reason why we recommended to Cabinet that we change the architecture is because we know that the architecture that we are implementing now, I'm talking now as we, as a CECOM, the architecture we're implementing now is an architecture that is likely to deliver results and deliver results quicker. Then there's an issue of the participation of local ICT players. One, when we issued the bid in 2013, we wanted a turnkey solution that had challenges, and we had to review our position to then buy the application, after buying the application, do the rollout and so on, which is now a three-phased approach that we're doing. In buying the software, you can only buy it from where the software is available, which is the original software manufacturers. And you need a software that meets certain criteria, and that criteria has been set by government, and that criteria then result in the number of participants being reduced in the manner that it has. But the approach to the rollout of the second project that has been adopted, it has been adopted deliberately because we want to increase the participation, and I think Cornell did emphasize this point in his presentation. We want to increase the participation of local companies in the rollout of the IFMS. So the second phase, once we've awarded at the end of the month which application are we using, then another bid is going to come out, which then invites implementation agencies that are going to come and help in the implementation of the IFMS while the configuration is taking place, so that when that configuration is done, then that participation. And there will be a deliberate effort to make sure that that participation is guaranteed. At another level, as an institution, generally, because there's a question around, there's a broader issue around this issue of participation, we have revised our procurement process, and we have developed an approach on involving local ICT players that we believe will improve on the work that has been done in the past quite significantly. I would not address myself to that necessarily. So will this help with this centralized supply chain? With an integrated system, it makes life easier. And as I understand, the centralization that the Minister of Finance and the Chief Procurement Officer are talking about is not everything. There are specific elements that are being centralized, and such elements are left in the department, and the system will be able to do that. Yes, we've missed opportunities. If we're able to deliver the IFMS system many, many years ago, we would have had the benefit of that integrated system. There would be a lot of things that are done much better and much more efficiently, and therefore there are indeed missed opportunities. But I think there are lessons, valuable lessons that have been learned in the project as well that should not be left. And then legal implications. And it goes to the questions around ICTWorks, IBM, and all of the other role players, essentially, that were participating in the old IFMS. I was asked by the TECOM to deal with this matter, meet with all of the service providers that had been part of the original IFMS. Before doing so, I sought legal opinion to understand all of the contracts that we had entered into, understand what are the implications of those contracts, what are the specific provisions, if this is terminated, what do the implications be. We came to the conclusion in that evaluation that, save for one or two contracts, there are minimal risks. Some of the contracts had run their course, some of the contracts had been delivered, and so on. So the risks were not as huge, except for one or two contracts that may still need to be renegotiated once the award is done. but all of the service providers that participated in the old IFMS. As when we issue the bid for implementation in the third phase, they will be free to participate in that process to the extent that there are legally binding obligations on the part of government that emanate from the previous project. Those we are in discussions with the different service providers at the moment to resolve those. And as government, the intention is that we shall not shy away from our obligations. We will meet those obligations as contained in those agreements. So I think that deals with those matters. But is it fruitless expenditure? I think we should have a much more diligent reading of the PFMA in as far as it relates to fruitless expenditure, so that we do not just take a broad brush on the issues, and then we can be specific to the extent that it has happened and deal with those instances where it has happened. Chair, I think I have addressed most of the questions that related to CETA in particular. The organization is in fact taking shape, and it's there are examples around of it doing the things that it needs to do and doing it the way it should do. Its past is not its future. It has a past, but I'm saying to this committee, it has a future that is very different from that past, and we ought to support it. Thank you.
Don't be afraid to say it has a bright future. Madlamini has a follow-up question.
Thank you so much. You know, I believe you because I've worked with you for 5 years.
Yeah. There is a bright future. I trust you. But there's just one request. Because now you're going to buy the software, the first bit that started to say, is it possible while you are negotiating, because I understand they're still negotiating with service providers about other issues, can you also negotiate an issue of taking 10 or 20 of our own to train them so that we avoid the maintenance cost? Because this will mean now every time we've got a problem, we call somebody from Germany or whoever, whatever country that will be giving the bid. That was my request, Chairperson. Thank you.
If I may address it, Chair, in the TECOM, one of the discussions that we're having is in the rollout phase, how do we then bring those people that will continue to support the system and bring them early into the configuration and the implementation stage so that they will be competent enough to support the system once the system becomes rolled out, but the colleague from the Treasury and PSA will address that if need be further. May I request, Chair, that I thank you.
Chair, we will finalize everything about RFMS, and then after that we can go to the feeding of the backend post, and then we go to the issue of the statistics. Go then.
Thank you, Chair and the Acting DG. Chair, the questions relating to cost, I will ask my colleagues from Treasury to deal with. There was a number of those, so I will just try to run through the list and see what else is there that's non-financial, which Mr. Nombalu has not addressed yet. Chair, you yourself asked a question about what the system will do in terms of combating sales corruption. It is one of the driving main reasons why we are looking at these modern systems. They have inherent capabilities that assist in rooting out corruption or preventing fraud and corruption. For example, it enforces segregation of duties, which means a person that captures a transaction cannot approve it. It has to be approved by somebody else. So there's already a check and balance in it. All these systems contain very strong audit trails, so there's a record of who did what on the system. Again, so if something happens, one is able to trace that back. The fact is, data becomes more visible, so more people see it, and hopefully, you know, if something goes wrong, a manager can intervene and make sure that Chair, it's used by numerous countries in the world. Remember, we haven't selected a solution yet, but these solutions are more or less all the same. So it is used by a range of both developing and developed countries across the world.
And then we are making sure that in the implementation of the system, we will specifically cater for, let's call it business processes that deal with anti-corruption, preventing fraud, rooting out malpractices. For example, the e-disclosure of senior managers. That is going to be an inherent part of the system. Currently, it's done on a standalone basis. We will have fields, you know, to where we can record which public servants do business with the state, which is another big thing and which we want to prevent. So, yes, it is a key focus area for us going forward. Jay, you also asked in terms of the vanilla solution, who will do, whether that will not lead to potential fraud corruption. I don't think so. As I explained, these systems do contain inherent safeguards, and we will also do further configuration to make sure that it meets our requirements. Then you raise the possibility of people being paid double when you migrate from one system to another. It hasn't occurred yet because we haven't implemented the new payroll system yet. Remember, PASOL is still there and we are still using it. But in our plans for the piloting of the new solution, there is provision for a double run period. So there will be, let's say, 3 months, which people, we will make sure that payments are processed both on PASOL and on the new system to make sure that both people are not paid double, but also there's not some people that don't get paid, which could also be, you know, if it's large numbers, cause huge, huge problems for the state. So, Chair, I think that deals with yours. The gentleman that asked about where IFMS has been piloted has left, but just briefly, it is or has been piloted in a limited number of departments. The HR module was piloted in DPSA itself, and we started an implementation in the Free State Department of Education, which was not completed. While that process was going on, the new cabinet decision was taken. Procurement management was piloted in National Treasury. And the asset management solution was implemented in Treasury as far as I know and in some departments in the program. So it was piloted, but in a limited number of departments. The gentleman also asked about policy-related challenges. We did not really have policy issues during the piloting phase. The challenges we encountered were more people-related, both in terms of technical skills to develop, customize, configure these systems, but also on the user side, we encountered significant resistance from some users, and it could be as a result of a variety of reasons. People are used to using the old systems. They may lack the necessary computer literacy. Maybe our training wasn't sufficient. So we learned very important lessons through that to guide our efforts going forward. Chair, let me just quickly run through the rest. Funding is, this is a lot of funding questions. Cost, legal, etc. Chair, job losses. There was a question around that. Chair, our thinking is there will be no job losses. The piloting we've done so far did not indicate that people will become redundant. But I do know there might be cases. And let's take leave management. It's an area I understand well. In some tech departments, you have people that are dedicated to capturing leave forms. That's all they do. Now, that job will fall away because it will be automated, so there's no need for capturing. But it's small numbers, and those people can be retrained in other areas of HR management. We don't really don't foresee, and I'm being honest, that people will lose their jobs as a result of implementation of IFMS. Lastly, Chair, we will do the configuration of the system. I think the Honourable Minister from the Best Side asked that. It will, Mr. Nombalu explained that. In the second tender, we are going to get service providers on board that will deal with the panel meeting on customization of the solution. You asked which domain will be implemented first. The answer is it will all be implemented simultaneously. It's an integrated system, so we want to take it all live at one time. It's not like the old IFMS where it was disparate systems that were implemented in a non-sequential way. So this time, big bang, everything. And then training, I'm not sure what the budget, whether there's specific budgets for that, but the training will happen just before we go live. That is also one of the lessons we learned. You train just before you start using the system. Otherwise, people forget what they learned. Chair, I think that was more or less it.
Maybe Treasury can just deal with the financial issues, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the members. Chair, I think that the most important thing that we realize today is that we have not communicated well enough about what we have done. And I think there's valuable input from the members who have guided us as to what is the kind of information that we need to share more regularly with the committee, but also not just with the committee, but also with the public. And therefore, I've just spoken to Lindy and said we must maybe do a booklet so that we explain all of these things more adequately going into the future. But we have taken the advice of the committee members. As I said, it's quite valuable, and we will make sure that we address all of those. Chair, if I can maybe just start, and I know it's slightly a duplication, but I think that we just need to explain exactly what fruitless and wasteful expenditure is. As the CEO has said in his past life, he was also the Accountant General, fruitless and wasteful expenditure is the expenditure incurred in vain. That's all it is. We cannot ascribe a different definition to it. So if it has not been incurred in vain, then it's not fruitless and wasteful. If it has been incurred in vain, then the whole amount becomes fruitless and wasteful. If you take
thank you, Chair. Also, can I? It had nothing to do with the presentation, even to explain the fruitless. I was making that one in relation to the misinformation provided in terms of incomplete qualifications and all those other things. It had nothing to do with us. I was just making an example. It's only that I didn't relate it to this one, but I was making an overall statement in terms of the terminology. Thank you, Chair.
I think in addition to that, the member was saying that we have a responsibility to also teach the public this connotation so that they understand. You know, once you say fruitless expenditure, she was just making it looks as if, you know, people have stolen money and all that. Where else it means something different. Okay.
No, thanks, Jay. So I'll leave it at that, but just to say thank you again to the member, because it is important, as has been pointed out, because the case reported incorrectly, where it is not that matter. Chair, but I will leave it there for now, if that's okay. Chair, the question about the cost implications. The cost implications, what we used for our budget was the last amount that was given to us by the people from CETA that calculated it in 2010. That was a cabinet member, which was never submitted. But at that point, CETA estimated that to complete the project would cost $4 billion in total. Now, there was a number of things that have not been taken into account. For example, that was the total current cost in current value. So it didn't take into account inflation that will happen over period. It could have been more at that figure. But the new budget that we have done, when we decided to change direction, we went to Cabinet and we said, whatever the commitment was that was made, we will not deviate from that. That's why the timelines are exactly the same, and that's why the amount is exactly the same. So we have done a budget now that which includes these factors like CPI. It also includes things like project management, which we didn't have in the past, dedicated people that work on the project. All of those things have now been taken into account, and still we are within the budget that has been presented at the time. The cost incurred so far is the figure that was mentioned is $1 billion. It's slightly more now because there has been some more expenses incurred, obviously, so it's about 1.2, 1.3. I don't have the exact figures. As to whether that has been wasted or can be reused, of course it can be reused. Currently, as we sit, the systems are being used. DPSA are using the system. We as National Treasury are using the system. So there's nothing that has been incurred that has been wasted. The user requirements need to be updated, of course, because the period has progressed. But if your requirement is that the new system must be able to capture a lead form, that requirements have not changed. So the money has not been wasted. Not just, of course, there's some money that will now have to be forfeited because we're going in a different direction. But in general terms, the amount, there has been no wastage as far as that is concerned. Chair, I just wanted to find the figure that was mentioned about 10% that can be reused. It's so far off the truth that you can't even think about how somebody can even think on any IT system that it could even be close to the figure. It is just way off. You know, maybe if they said 10% cannot be reused, that would have made more sense. The budget implications are phase one and going forward. As I said, we stick to the amount that has been given to us. Some people don't just help me if I've missed any of them. But just to say that if we have missed any points, we will address all of them and send a formal response to the committee if we don't answer right now. Thanks, Chief, and I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Chair and the Honourable Members. I think you've given us good guidance as well as thought-provoking issues to take forward because of the urgency with which you see us dealing with the issue of vacancies, and it's appreciated. Chair, the question you asked us is what do we want from the committee? And I'll deal with that first. I think increased accountability of departments for not meeting targets and adhering to government processes. So when they table the annual reports, ask them what the vacancy rate is. Ask them what the target for disability is, the equity targets in senior management. And they should do that before they do the other presentation. And ask them what's the vacancy rate and whether they have an HR plan or are they restructuring and get a sense of the level of urgency that's communicated. Chair, the point around the posts that was raised, what happens when a post is not filled? I think one of the Honourable Members raised the issue. Resources drive service delivery. It's people. And if you don't have them and you've been and they are budgeted for, it creates an inefficiency in service delivery. And we cannot afford that. So what happens when a post is not filled is it remains unfilled until such time a decision is taken to abolish it or to reconfigure and redirect the resources for that position. We must remember that decisions around personnel and structure and posts reside at the local level at the competence of each EA and accounting officer. So DPSA at most is able to facilitate these blockages. The question raised about what is the main factor for non-filling of posts. We've raised a number of them in a general matter, but what you find at specific departments based on their functional mandates, based on the skills required, and based in terms of their location and funding, there are unique issues around each one of them. So in departments that's reorganizing or reconfiguring, it may cause delays in vacancies. In the Department of Health or Education, there may be issues around professionals and clinicians for staffing hospitals. So there's around scarcity and so on. So they are varied, but they're multiple, and most issues are localized. We've got to get departments to own the problem and deal with it. The question raised around what is the model, I'm going to deal with vacancies. What is the model for dealing with a funded vacancy? What is a funded vacancy? A funded vacancy is a position which you have been awarded funding in the compensation budget in terms of the estimates of national expenditure from Treasury. Money was awarded to a department to pay a human resource to deliver a function. And that's a funded vacancy. So what's an unfunded vacancy? A department may be funded for 500 posts, but in the design of their structure, they may have 700. Those 200 posts which are not funded are still part of their structure, but not part of the establishment for which they will get resources for. Now, we've urged departments to phase in positions that as and when funding becomes available over the NTF or Treasury. Where departments take their third year, the outer year, vacancy, and automatically make it go live, it appears as a vacancy, and we count it. So it's like a wish list. You know, you want to have a house with 5 rooms, but you can only afford 3. And if you put in that you have 5 rooms, and your rates will go up and everything will go up, and it's constant. You cannot negate it. Regarding the issue, one of the Honourable Member raised about the outliers and the departments. In future, what we will do is not cluster the data around provinces. We will bring the data to you around at a granulated level per department as annexes to the presentation, so you can see who they are and what's happening. I think the key issue that's been raised is that in principle, any vacancy affects the quality of service of government, and we need to deal with it at an urgent level. Chair, the issue of the youth, the DPSA is currently developing and piloting a model for graduate recruitment in the public service. That's on our medium-term strategic framework, and for this year we have to develop and pilot a model on graduate recruitment, and it will go a long way to addressing the issues around youth. The rest of the questions deal with the issue of verifications. Chair, and the first question that was asked was the capacity of the two institutions, SACO and the State Security Agency. Admittedly, it's a large volume of work, but we must know we put rules in place to be followed. They create inefficiencies because it's easier to break a rule than to follow it, and that takes discipline. So what we need to do is deal with the inefficiencies at the significant and strategic level. The institution's best place to speak on the issue of capacity and some of the challenges they're having in this area are the State Security Agency and SACO. It may be more prudent to get them to come in and explain together with DIET what is it they are doing on those issues. And the issues raised around fraudulent qualifications, we must remember we are finding them out because we are looking for them. We want to root them out. It's not happening by accident. A decision made by the state to root out corruption and to deal with fraudulent qualifications is necessary, but it's happening not in an ad hoc manner. It's happening in a concerted manner, and people are being found out. Where they are being found out, they are being charged. Chair. I can't speak to the state-owned enterprises, but for the public, Chair, I can't answer that, but I can tell you.
That in fact you would not even be embarrassed that people will have to be reported to the newspapers. I personally feel that you're not doing enough. In fact, those that we've learned about, I think they are done by private companies, not yourself. Well, I stand to be corrected.
Thank you, Chair. I agree, we are not doing enough and fast enough. The issue around vetting, any cost related to vetting and qualification verification, fraudulent qualifications, when they are found, that the cost is not considered to be fruitless and wasteful, because it was designed to be spent to discover whether the qualification is valid. The issue is that once it's found out, and for example, an higher education institution presses charges with police, the matter then becomes a matter for the criminal courts. However, once that is found, the person then has a criminal record if they are charged. And that criminal record comes up again in the verification. Our biggest challenge around the vetting issues are around the time factor. It is the time factor. We need to, and the issue around the time has to deal with the technology it brings in and efficiency. We have to find it. The points raised about capturing information, I agree, can be done, but then you've got to quality assure that information, because changing a 1983 to a 1982 on a database has significant impact on that person's ability to earn an income. So we need to be mindful of it. But I think overall the key issues that were raised have been around the efficiency of the process which we are dealing with, and it's at the highest level between the accounting officers of the institutions, as well as streamlining the process so that we don't create risk while trying to do it efficiently. And we will continue to engage and report on those issues. The number of 30,000 public servants versus the 1.3, we must remember we have been doing the qualification verification since 2008. 30,000 was the amount that was verified last year. So the aggregate figure, I don't have it here, but we can make it available. No, it's 30,000 that was done in 1 year. 1 year. So the aggregate figure at 2008 until now, but we only reported. Yes. Thank you, sir.
Can I just make a follow-up on the verification of qualifications? When some people were reported, then someone said it's just the tip of an iceberg. There are more problems to that. Do we have any reason to feel uneasy about that?
Thanks, Chair. I think in case of what Jiva should have reported is that we operate only within the Public Service Act. Yes, in case of the verification there, we are doing ourselves, but in case of some of the outside institution, it's not us that are doing that. But what we are trying to do, as he indicated, come into building capacity to be able to do that on ourselves, because some of the things are the shared responsibility. You find you just collect document, you take it to SAPA. Or sometimes in case of verification when coming to vetting, you collect document, you take it to state, what you call, to Punea. So we are trying to create the capacity to say, why don't we have vetting inside, we do filing and everything, and then in case of the finalization of the process, the certificate will be from there. The SAPA process also, we try to integrate our system to say, why don't we do all this to configure that, and then they will just be able to verify and be able to give it to us. Because when you look at the chief directorate that is heading, I mean, it's a small chief directorate, but looking at the larger number that is dealing with, it needs much capacity because you need to verify. When you look at how many posts are we filling in case of the SMS, each and every time there's a delay in case of, pre-verification or finalization, you find it's still a denomination process. That is why when he presented, you will find when you talk about some of the vacancies, it's because it's a denomination still waiting for the mayor to finalize, the vetting process in case of the clearance, pre-screening and everything. So now that we said, we are trying to build the capacity in that field.
I do understand the capacity issue, but what I'm trying to establish is that are there more people who have faked their qualifications within the system? Are we still going to hear of more people being reported on the same issue? Do you have an idea as to whether or not? Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the critical point that the Chairperson raised was to say what needs to be done, and the DPSA says Parliament must increase accountability, but I believe that accountability must be increased within departments themselves, because all these things that are happening are not happening due to lack of regulation. DPSA has done a lot of work around developing frameworks and directives after directives, but the issue is non-compliance by departments themselves. For instance, the issue of qualification checks that the chairperson is raising now, DPSA issued a directive, but the departments continue to employ people without going through the verification process. They employ people without checking their qualifications when the directive is there to say check these qualifications, with the hope that sometimes some departments would even write a letter that if it's found that you don't get security vetting or qualification checks, something is found that it's not correct,
you will be terminated, your services will be terminated, forgetting that they will have to go through the process of Section 17 of the Public Service Act. They can't say to that person, okay, thank you, go today. But due to their non-compliance, they even, you know, cut corners and write those letters to say you are employing you without following the processes that they know. I think the problem is with the department, and I believe that accountability by the departments themselves can be worked out. These things can be pinned on performance agreements of HODs themselves, so that if an HOD signs an appointment for someone whose qualifications have not been checked, or a person who hasn't been vetted, then the accounting officer must take responsibility for that, and not Parliament, because those people are not appointed by Parliament. So even if accountability can be increased by Parliament, that departments themselves must take responsibility.
Yeah,
yeah,
no, I say that because there is missing communication of authority and all those other things. But having said that, probably what we are saying at this point is that we simply go out there and inform all the teachers that they must inform all their subordinates throughout the system to say if you suspect that you have provided a sort of non-correct qualifications, please retrieve them. If you think you have misrepresented your qualifications, please retrieve them to avoid the embarrassment, because it goes to us as the ruling party, unfortunately. But it goes to you that we are not going to recycle you anymore because you are misleading us also sitting here. So if you can do that one, it is in your forums. It's easy as that. But also, I wanted to raise the issue of, because we can call all the DGs, which means we are going to be working, calling all the DGs, and what will be the role of integration and responsibility and accountability and management of PPSA and MNE in the whole scheme of things there. Chair, the other one that I wanted to raise in terms of, I don't quite agree with PPSA if they say that to take the information of 1982 for argument's sake, to put it in the system, it will disturb the pay system, because there's a document management. That you scan the document, if you can see the writing, and you put it there, and we'll say it makes life much easier. So those are the other things that, and I'm sure you are aware, PPSA, why we are dealing with the public service in terms of your national and provincial government. But other metros, they've already started writing in terms of building plans and everything, because information gets lost. But if your document management system is on scratch, you'll never fall toward that one. So I just want you to raise that thing that sometimes we give the reasons to make us happy so that you don't make questions, but also just think outside the box and borrow from other levels of government. It might help. Thank you.
Can we request Colette to bail us on some of the things? Colette?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just in terms of the evolving mandate of DPSA in terms of the new regulatory and legislative environment, the Palmer is going to put a lot of pressure on DPSA to ensure that norms and standards are in place that can oversee regulatory compliance around a number of these areas. So I think as we unpack the regulatory expectations, the aspects of compliance against all these systems and processes would have to be in place. And I think it would make it much easier for oversight from our function together with the integrated function of other centres of government departments, you know, to ensure that those minimum norms and standards have been met.
Thank you. Quite a number of the questions really centered around what can be done and what would we like the committee to do to make things better. And also there was a question around increase, around the capacity which was left reported in the Public Service Commission report. I think generally in terms of the work that I do and my team, transformation for gender equality and equal access for people with disabilities, I am not convinced that the matter is taken seriously. And we would like support from all forces, from the members of the committee, without diminishing our monitoring role. I think the more monitoring bodies call DGs to account, call ministers, I often feel, for example, the appointment of DGs and DDGs is done through cabinet. And surely every department, every minister who presents an appointment has got to be able to account for how is that going to impact on equity within the department. And I think that is where we would like the portfolio committee to assist us. We would also like to ask the portfolio committee, every time you meet with any manager for whatever topic, it should become standard procedure to ask them to account. Because the more we force staff and officials to look at their work from a gender lens perspective or disability, it is going to become a forgotten matter. Because yes, it's true, as the Public Service Commission said, DPSA has got enough framework, policy, it is the application. And for the Public Service Commission, the DPSA and the Presidency, I think it's very important that also this whole issue of performance assessment of people. How do we integrate questions and statements that would enable those who evaluate the DGs to account for issues like that? There are some DGs who feel that we can't put it in performance agreements because everybody wants everything in the performance agreements of DGs. But I think through the process of performance assessment, the nature of the accounting and the questioning could be addressed there. And skills development. I think 2005, the Public Service Commission did an assessment of the extent of gender mainstreaming in the public service. The picture that was presented was the report. It indicated that the skill of mainstreaming gender, and I would say even disability, was at a very low level. Lots of initiatives were introduced by the DPSA. So 2 years ago, we decided at DPSA to run a similar assessment to check the extent to which departments responded to some of the critique of the Public Service Commission. And what we have found is that departments do not take your report seriously. Some of the issues, the problems, and specific to gender mainstream, we have a detailed report that, for example, tells that appointment of staff members that have the responsibility for gender and disability does not necessarily look at the skills of the people. If you are a woman or a man in a department and you say, by the way, what are we doing for Women's Day? Oh, we're going to make you a gender focal person. And the level of expertise is not what it's supposed to be. And that needs to be looked at. And once you have that leadership in programming core, obviously, people are going to focus on events. They are not going to ensure that policies of departments mainstream gender and disability. They are not going to make sure that the spend of the department looks at businesses owned by women, businesses owned by persons with disability. So yes, it is true. We, as much as we are chasing the target, we are starting to focus more significantly on the implementations of our strategic framework. Because those strategic frameworks begin to force officials to create an enabling environment. And it is only when you have the enabling environment that you will then begin to see the numbers falling into place. So there's a lot of training required. There are lots of things that are not going right that contribute to the achievement of this 2%. But for us, it isn't just that the equity target. If you look at the last, the value, it is a transformation process. You can have the numbers almost like you can be BEE compliant but be far from transformed. And what we target in is transformation.
Thank you very much. We won't stop until the 2% and the 50% has been achieved. In fact, in our agenda, we should not put it up until 50% all the time. It cannot be correct, but the meeting took longer than I expected. So we will wait for the correct response with regard to the wage bill, and then you also have the responsibility to also rely on the making sure that the shared department will also do what is required of us. Will increase accountability of government departments and the enforcement of the implementation of decisions as well. We also want to propose that you come up with proposals in terms of punitive measures on non-compliance. Maybe it's on 50%, 2%, what did we talk about again? On small issues, just punitive measures, you know, come up with this proposal. Because people continuously do wrong things knowing that nobody, nothing will happen to you. So if you say you have the possibility to come up with proposals, okay. The policy on recruitment, do we have that policy? Do we have the policy? Recruitment policy for public service. We should have, no? Maybe?
Let's check in the impact.
Okay, but then I think we need to have an overall policy recruitment where issues of gender and disability will be enforced. And young people as well. Youth, no? We are grateful of this meeting because it forces departments to talk to each other. In your own corner, as you know, you promote the intergovernmental relations is very important. That's where we'll be able to share those practices and also avoid possible duplications that might be. I think we have a good meeting. We will have to stop now. And if there are issues that you thought that you needed to write back.